Let's defend the convoy, pushing back the raider attacks with everything they have. Tiberius's fire spreads through the trees, the ash falling around us like snow, coating us in white and gray. I let my lightning crack across the sky, the sound and force of it enough to send the raiders scurrying back into the trees. In the darkness, it's hard to discern their shadows. They don't look like the Silvers I'm used to, in fine robes, polished armor, and gleaming jewels. They don't even have the neat severity of training suits and uniforms. These Silvers are different, their clothes a patchwork, their weapons and gear mismatched. I'm reminded, more than anything, of the Scarlet Guard, in their scraps of red, united only by a color and a cause. The cycles disappear into the smoky underbrush, their headlights bobbing and weaving out of sight. I reach for the engines, trying to grab hold before they pass beyond my grasp, but another rumble makes me pause, a pounding thrum lurching close. I can feel it in my teeth. Monsters burst from the ash, their shaggy heads massive, horns lowered, hooves stamping. Dozens of them, snorting and braying in hulking ranks. The stampede pummels into the convoy, knocking over each transport, even as they meet bullets and fire and lightning and knives. The monsters are too strong, too strange. Their hides thick, muscles thicker, with bone like living armor. I watch one catch a bullet in the forehead and keep on ramming, horns tearing through metal like paper. I barely have the wherewithal to scream. Our transport tips beneath us, knocked off the road by the monstrous charge. We topple with it. I hit the dirt hard and taste blood. Someone holds me down, their hand on my neck. Through my hair, I glimpse the transport as it sails over us. Evangeline is silhouetted against the sight, arms outstretched, fists clenched. She swings, using the transport like a battering ram, and tosses it into the stampeding herd of fearsome creatures. They circle and charge again, their eyes wide and furious, clearly under the control of a silver Animos. I scramble up, using Tiberius's arm to leverage my weight and get back on my feet. Some yards away, Farley fires her gun from a knee. Her bullets have no effect on the beasts as they run, closing the distance quickly. Gritting my teeth, I toss and spread, weaving purple-white lightning across their path. The beasts rear in terror, still animals despite whoever is controlling them. A few attempt to run through. They scream in pain, collapsing in heaps of twitching hide and tossing horns. I try to ignore the terrible sound and narrow my eyes, squinting through the semi-darkness as fear gives way to instinct. My movements come without thought, every step and sweep of my arms immediate. In my focus, I almost don't notice the creeping sensation, the heavy weight falling around my shoulders. The press is gentle at first, easy to mistake for exhaustion. But my lightning wanes, not as bright as before, not as easy to control. It flickers, sparking weakly as I brush aside another raider. He falls but gets back up quickly, a fist clenched in my direction. The force of his ability sends me to my knees, and I lose all sensation of electricity, like a candle snuffed out, unable to spark and burn. I can't breathe. I can't think. I can't fight. Silence, a voice in me screams. A familiar pain and familiar fear level me again, bending me over. My useless hands hit the dirt, brushing against cold earth. I gasp weakly, barely able to move, let alone defend myself. Fear sends me spiraling, my vision going black for a second. I feel manacles again, silent stone around my wrists and ankles, keeping me prisoner behind a locked door, chaining me to a false king, dooming me to a life of slow, wasting death. The silver stalks toward me, his footsteps thunderous in my ears. I hear the sing of rasping metal as he draws a knife, intending to make quick work of my throat. It flashes in the night, reflecting the flames with a red sheen. He grins at me, his face bloodless and white, as he grabs my hair, forcing my head back. I want to fight him. I should reach for the gun at my hip, still holstered, but my limbs won't move. Even my heartbeat feels sluggish. I can't even scream. The combination of crushing silence and fear keeps me still. All I can do is watch. The blade edges my skin, almost burning me with its cold. He leers down at me, his hair greasy beneath the scarf wrapped around his forehead. I can't tell what color the fabric is, if it means anything. A useless thing to wonder right now. Then, His face explodes. Shards of bone and torn flesh arc forward. His body follows the momentum, slumping over me, and the thunderous touch of electricity returns as quickly as he falls. I scramble, unthinking, sliding out from under the silence's corpse, even as his warm blood and splintered teeth catch in my hair. Someone grabs me beneath the arm, dragging me through the dirt. I let them, still in shock, still paralyzed by fear, unable to do much more than kick weakly at the ground. In the distance, Farley watches me with a murderous expression, her pistol still raised and aimed at a man already dead.
"It's me,"
a deep voice says, laying me down some yards away, or rather, letting me drop. Tiberius stands back, eyes wide and almost glowing in the dim light. His breath comes in quick puffs as he looks me over. "Stand up," I tell myself. "Get back on your feet." If only I could. If only the memory of Silent Stone were so easy to brush off. Slowly, I brush my hands together, calling sparks to my skin. I have to see them. I have to know they aren't gone again. Then I touch my throat, my fingers coming away slick with my own blood. Tiberius watches in silence, unblinking. I stare back until he turns away, putting reluctant distance between us. When I get my bearings, I realize I'm somewhat defended. He dumped me next to the transports, using the wrecks for cover. All around me, soldiers of Montfort reform along the line. Davidson stalks among them, a streak of blood across his face. He looks disgusted with himself and with the raiders. Shaky, I climb to my feet, using the hulking vehicle above me for support. The battle still rages before us, and the monstrous beasts snort and stamp, at odds with their own nature and their silver masters. A net of white lightning forms ahead of them, like a fence to hold them back. They toss their heads at the display, frightened beyond sense. I know the feeling.
"Poor things,"
I hear Titan mutter as he stops next to me. He stares at the beasts, strangely forlorn. When one tries to charge, he blinks and it drops, its massive body crumpling. The raiders return for another pass, their cycles snarling and leaping through the thinning trees. Evangeline and her cousins do battle with the other magnetrons, wrestling for dominance over the cycles. One hand on my chest, nails clutching at my suit, I try to grab hold of a cycle as it leaps over the road. Glaring, I trace the lines of electricity into its engine. With a great push of resolve, I feel them die in quick succession, a sudden burst and then nothing. The rider twists, startled, as his machine fails. Breathing hard, I do the same to the next. They fall one by one, either coasting to a stop or toppling in midair. Our own soldiers descend on the raiders. They must have orders to capture, not kill. Davidson himself imprisons one in a cage of shields, letting the raider pound uselessly at his blue prison. Evangeline pursues one of the small raider magnetrons, running him down over the dirt. He tries to duel her, swirling twin blades that bleed between sword and whip. She is faster and more deadly. His swords are no match for her knives as they pepper his skin, her ability too strong for him to overcome. Evangeline Samos owes no allegiance to Davidson, and she doesn't have his mercy. She cuts the raider apart, letting him bleed silver beneath the starlight. Between the blood and the ash, the low foothills smell and taste like death. I gulp down the wretched air anyway, trying to catch my breath. The remaining raiders know the battle is lost, and their engines begin to ebb away, attempting to escape into the wilderness. As they disappear, so does their influence, and the herd of beasts calms. They turn, charging away into the forest, leaving only corpses and trampled underbrush behind.
"Was that what you call a bison?"
I pant, glancing at Davidson. He nods grimly, and I swallow around the irony. I can still feel the bison steak in my stomach, heavy as a stone. In the distance, some ways down the road, headlights flare out of the plane. I clench a fist, tensing for a second wave. But Titan puts a hand on my arm. He looks down at me with flashing eyes.
"It's the Golden Grove transports. Reinforcements."
Relief floods me, and I drop my shoulders, exhaling.
The movement sends a twinge through the cut on my back. I hiss, wincing, and put up a hand to feel the damage. The gash is long, but not so deep. A few yards away, Tiberius watches me take stock of my wounds. He jumps when I meet his gaze and spins on his heel. "I'll get you a healer," he mutters, stalking off.
"If you're done crying over paper cuts, I could use some help."
Still on the ground, Farley gestures with one hand, her teeth clenched together tightly. Her gun lies in the dirt, surrounded by spent bullet casings. One of them saved my life. She leans to one side, careful not to move her right leg, because her knee is wrong. My vision swims for a second. I've seen many forms of injury, but the way her knee twists, the lower half of her leg out of position, something about it turns my stomach. I immediately forget the ache in my own muscles, the blood on my shoulder, even the touch of silence, and rush to her side.
"Don't move," I hear myself say.
"No shit," she growls back, her hands tight on mine.
10. Iris. The mountains are steep and perilous, guarding the valley cities from siege or an army's onslaught. The thick pines make for dangerous obstacles to any transport that dares to turn off their defended roadways. And the elevation alone is a deterrent, weakening any who might hope to climb their way up into the city's jaws. They think themselves safe in their fortress of cliff and sky. They see no danger, for no army could hope to march to their door. But we are often made weak by what also makes us strong. Montfort is no exception. We land to the east, outside their borders, well within the bounds of prairie. Our drop jet is unmarked, freshly painted in prairie gold for appearance sake. It blends well with the tall grass as it sways like waves beneath the morning light. No one notices our arrival, out on the distant plains. We flew carefully, first through the wilds of the Lakelands, before crossing the open and empty landscape. The prairie lords are far-flung, their lands too vast and sprawling to patrol properly. And they are preoccupied with their own doings. They don't know we crossed their lands. No one knows we're here. Except the raiders, of course. Their involvement is necessary, to lure as many as we can out of Ascendant. With any luck, Tiberius Calor will be one of them. According to Maven, his brother would never pass up an opportunity to fight. "To show off," he added, scowling at the idea when we discussed this. I don't know the exiled prince. I've never met Tiberius Calor, but the Lakelands is not a blind country. We collected intelligence on him and all the royal family. They were our enemies for more than a century, after all. The reports revealed an altogether predictable prince, raised to be a military leader like his father, hammered by duty and exception, formed into a person who values the crown above all else. The brothers have that in common, I think, along with a very peculiar red girl. I have to agree with Maven's assessment. If Tiberius really is here to bargain with Montfort, to strengthen their alliance, he will certainly try to prove himself and win their loyalty. What better way than to fight for them? The raiders meet us at the agreed-upon location, a rise allowing full view of the surrounding landscape. They are masked and veiled, sitting astride smoke-spitting old-fashioned cycles, with even their eyes obscured by riding goggles. Silvers, all of them. Exiled from their own lands when the mountain kingdoms fell, stripped of their own birthrights as lords and rulers. They outnumber us, but I feel little fear. I am a warrior by birth, bred by the strongest nymphs in my kingdom, and my 5 escorts are just the same, strong, noble, and useful. Giudansa is still with me, eager to serve as well as protect. She's careful to position herself between me and any raider who might come too close. I keep my head down, my own face shadowed. The riders are an isolated kind, and they probably wouldn't know a princess of the Lakelands or the Queen of Norta on sight. But it's best this way. The others speak for me, going over the arrangement. Our team of 6 is easy to transport, each of us clinging to one of the raiders as they ferry us across the plain. They know this land better than any of us, and we don't even need to use our shadow of House Haven to hide our journey. Not yet. The mountains in the distance loom closer with every passing second. They look more like a wall than any mountains I've ever seen. Fear tries to eat at my resolve, but I don't let it. Instead, I narrow my eyes and sharpen my focus on the task at hand, leaving little room for anything else. As the hours bleed together, I run over the plan in my head, each obstacle to be surmounted. Cross the border. That is done easily. The raiders know their paths, and they know Montfort's blind spots. They follow a stream through tight, dense pine forest, and only when we start climbing into the foothills do I realize we're on the other side of the invisible dividing line between Prairie and Montfort. Pay for your passage. The string of jewels is mine, sapphire, silver, and diamond. I hand them over at gunpoint. Our Haven Shadow, a young, stocky sentinel on loan from my royal husband, gives up the more valuable piece of the bargain. His own house is split, torn in two by the civil war erupting across Norta. The head of his house fights for Tiberius, but the majority of his kin remain at Maven's side. An admirable thing, to be loyal to country and king over family, even if that king is Maven Kalor. He doesn't wear his sentinel mask, leaving the black jewel tradition behind. Without it, he seems human. Blue eyes, red hair gleaming in the sunlight. Sentinel Haven gives the raiders the location of our resource drop some miles north. Crates of food, coin, batteries, as well as arms and ammunition to feed their endeavors. The raiders waste no time leaving us on the eastern mountainside, as high as they could ride. I never see their faces, but at least one has blonde hair, a few strands of it visible beneath his wrapped head coverings. Climb. The waterfalls are simple enough. They act as moving ladders, and I use the water to pull us up and over a great many cliffs. I eventually lose count of them. We follow the stream backward, against the current, with little difficulty. Between my ability and that of another nymph, Leiron of the Norton House Osanos, all six of us manage to get into the high valley as the stars prick to life overhead. Still, the way is rough. The air thins and my breathing turns shallow, making my steps harder with every inch of the ascent. But I am no stranger to physical exertion. I trained at Citadel of the Lakes from childhood. The Haven Man keeps his hands free, fingers twitching now and then. He blankets us in invisibility, allowing us to move through the pines unseen. It's an odd thing to look down at your own feet and see nothing but the underbrush. At least I don't have to look at Rydal, the Rumbo strong arm. On the way up, his bulk was distorted by the two bodies strapped across his shoulders like a pack. Another part of my own plan. A bloody part. Again, I push away a shiver of fear. We began our climb farther north of the city, forcing us to cut back south to reach the river. It is dammed downstream, in the valley where Ascendant lies, creating a crooked lake. I feel some weight lift when we reach the water, its banks quiet and empty. Together, the six of us descend beneath its surface, leaving no trace of ourselves behind. I turn my attentions on the current, creating a channel of flowing water along the riverbed. Leiron does as we planned. Bubbles form around our heads, giving each of us a shield of breathable air. It's an old nymph trick, something a child could do. And so we pass in secret along the waterway, riding the current through the turns of the valley. It's almost pitch black, but I trust the water. The last miles pass in forced silence, filled only with the sound of my own breathing and my own pounding heartbeat. The Ascendant City Lake is deep and full of fish. Once or twice I jump at the brush of scales and darkness as we navigate to the edge of the water. I shrug off the sensation, focusing on the next step in my plan. Several fine estates have docks on the lake, and we use them as cover. I surface first, raising my eyes just above the waterline. After hours in the wilderness and underwater, even the soft lights of the city are glaring. I don't blink or flinch. I force my eyesight to adjust as quickly as I can. We have a schedule to keep. No alarms yet. No warning signals. Good. Sentinel Haven shrouds us again as we leave the water, but even he can't hide the wet footprints that trail us through the alleyways. That is left to Leiron and me. We wring ourselves dry with a few twists, using our abilities to squeeze every drop out. I condense the resulting puddles, casting away floating orbs of water into the nearest plant or gutter, leaving no trace. I spent the flight to Prairie memorizing the layout of Ascendant, using the map from Bracken. It unsettles me to know so much of my plan is built on someone else's work. I have to trust the information I was given, even if one wrong piece could mean failure. Though the Montfort capital is confusing, a jagged network of streets and steps along both sides of the valley floor, I was able to trace the quickest route from the dammed lake up to where Bracken's children are being held. Not in the palace, according to the Piedmont spies, but in an observatory. From the safety of a dark and silent alleyway, I glance up the stepped slopes to the domed building high on the mountainside. My legs shudder at the thought of climbing another few thousand feet, but I push forward without a sound, schooling my breath to a low, even pace, in through the nose, out through the mouth, in tandem with my steps. The strong arm has little trouble with the stairs, despite the extra weight of his cargo. And the Haven Sentinel is better trained than any of us. Raised to defend the king and his family, he is in prime physical form. The same can be said of Leiron. I'm loath to trust a Norden, let alone three at my side, but it couldn't be helped. An even representation was required for politics' sake. Judansa is the only companion I trust completely. The other Lakelander with us sets my teeth on edge. I loathe Nero of the Iscariol line, but we need him and his talents. He's a skin healer, a strange one. A person gifted with the ability to save life should not enjoy taking it as much as he does. I can hear him breathing, inhaling and exhaling rapidly as we ascend. Though I'm glad to have a healer as talented as he is at our backs, I wish he weren't necessary. Nero takes too much delight in what he must do before the night is done.
With luck, they won't be noticed until midday, he whispers. My work will be perfect.
His voice is smooth, silken. Nero comes from a long line of diplomats, just as adept at healing political alliances as they are at fixing broken bones. Keep silent, I murmur back at him. The ghost of his presence is somehow colder than the mountain air. Ascendant is not undefended. Guard posts and patrols dot the way, though far less than I've seen in the Lakelands or the Norden capital. These foolish Montfortans think their mountains and their secrets are enough to keep them safe. I glance over my shoulder at the other side of the valley. I feel the swish of my black braid, but can't see it. What must be the Premier's palace sprawls across the height opposite us, with other estates and government buildings lining its edges. It gleams white in the starlight, with many lights glowing from balconies, windows, and terraces. Mare Barrow is in there, the lightning girl with a knack for survival. I thought her a delightful curiosity in Archaon. The red girl leashed to a silver king, who seemed just as trapped by her as she was by him. I won't pretend to understand why she bewitches Maven in such a way, but it must be his mother's doing. No person of sound mind carries such obsession. And it cannot be love. No person capable of love acts the way he does. I never thought I would marry for love. I'm not naive enough for such daydreams. My parents grew to love and respect each other through their arrangement, and I hoped for that at least. Of course, Maven makes that hope impossible. I've had only small glimpses into his heart, and they are enough to know that his heart is dead. If the Bracken children were not our objective, if I actually hoped to maintain my Norden crown, I might entertain the idea of killing Mare Barrow. Not for spite, but to hopefully give Maven some clarity. She is a motivation now, a carrot for him to follow. But she is a weakness, too. And I need him weak. I need him distracted. As Mother said, Maven Kalor will face the Flood. They all will. The military contingent left 10 minutes ago, their transports screaming up the mountain. I can still hear the echoes coming down the slope, reverberating through the streets and alleys of the Montfort capital. The rest of the city clangs with alarm bells and warning signals, just as planned. I blink, still shrouded in Sentinel Haven's impenetrable shadow. The observatory guards abandon their posts to assist the city, leaving behind a skeleton shift of 2 Montfort soldiers. At night, their green uniforms seem black. They stand out against the polished moonstone columns, holding up the spangled dome of stained glass. Without a singer or a whisper to wipe the memories of both guards, we have no choice but to slip by them instead. It isn't difficult, but I hold my breath as we do, weaving through the observatory columns. They flank the entrance, still and steady, accustomed to the clanging alarms. Raider attacks are common, I'm told, and of little threat to the capital.
"On the plane," one says to the other, turning his face.
His compatriot shakes her head.
"On the slopes. They hit the plains twice last month."
The male guard grins, shoving his hand in his pocket.
"Plane. Bet you 10 coppers.
"Don't you get tired of losing your money to me?" she replies. As they laugh, grins wide, I press my hand to the lock of the door. With my other hand, I flick open the canteen holstered at my side. Under Sentinel Haven's power, I can't see what I'm doing, and so must rely on touch. It complicates things, but only enough to slow me down. The water swirls around my wrist, kissing my skin, before worming between my fingers and into the keyhole. It fits to the mechanism, filling the space as I exhale. Through the water, I press along the tumblers of the lock, touching each one, forming a key of my own making. I nudge sideways with my foot, reaching for Jadansa. She nudges back. Some yards away, a tree branch cracks under her ability, crashing to the paved stone, perfectly masking the sound of a turning lock.
"Raiders in the city?"
the female guard says, her laughter replaced by panic.
"No bet,"
the man responds. They rush to investigate, leaving us to slip into the observatory undetected, unseen, unlooked for. Wary of any kind of security cameras, Sentinel Haven keeps us shrouded as we enter.
"Leyron, through,"
whispers the Norton nymph. We sound off in turn, unable to see one another.
"Jadansa."
"Rydal."
"Nero."
"Iris."
"Delos,"
says the Haven sentinel. Grinning, I ease the door shut behind us. Infiltrate the observatory prison. Done. I don't allow myself a sigh of relief. That won't come until I'm on the ground at home, with Bracken's children safely returned. And even that is premature. As Mother would say, no use sleeping while there are wars to be won. And we certainly have a war exploding around us. Jadansa's footsteps echo slightly as she rounds the room. Her search takes several long minutes, enough to put us on edge. The tension ratchets with the passing seconds until she returns. I can hear the smile in her voice.
"They are truly foolish," she says. "No cameras, not one."
"How can that be?"
I hear Leyron mutter. My teeth grit together. "Perhaps they don't want a record of the children being here," I reply, giving the only explanation I can think of. It shouldn't affect me. Horrible things are done in war, even to Silvers. I know that firsthand.
Or what they've done to them.
The realization settles over us, another curtain of dread upon the pile. I raise my chin, smoothing my unseen hair, tucking pieces behind my ears. "Sentinel Haven, you may cease."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
I can hear him bow, and then I see it. We bleed into vision, all of us at once, as if a window has suddenly been wiped clean. Most look at their own limbs, examining themselves. But Nero is staring at me. He looks paler in the dim light filtering through the glass dome, which dapples his face in sickly green. His gaze feels like a challenge, or perhaps an amusement. I dislike either option.
"This way,"
I tell them, focusing on the task at hand. They fall into line, even Nero, and I'm glad to have Jidansa on my heels. The Sentinel, too. I'm the Queen of Norta, and he is sworn to protect me as well as Maven. We round a massive telescope pointed at the domed roof, made of tubes of brass and glass fixtures. A waste, I think. The stars are well beyond the reach of anyone, even Silver's. They are the realm of gods and gods alone. They are not for us to fathom. To try is to squander time, resources, and energy. Several chambers lead off the round central room, but we ignore them. Instead, I cross the floor, searching the marble beneath my feet for visible cracks. I don't expect any, and loose the canteen again. With a nod at Leiron, I have him do the same. Our water spreads around our feet and across the marble, expanding to the thinnest of covers. It prods and puddles over the stone, working into grooves and seams between the slabs. "Here," Leiron says, taking a few steps toward the wall. His own water bunches up like a giant droplet. As I approach, squinting, I can see tiny air bubbles trailing up through the water. There is open space below. Jidansa makes quick work of the slab, drawing it up and out of place with a wave of her fingers. Beneath, darkness looms, but not blackness. There are lights in the chamber below the observatory, somewhere farther down the passage. Enough to see by, but not to bleed through the tiny seams of the trapdoor slab. Stairs lead downward, as if beckoning. Rydal goes first, according to our plan, with Nero behind, one hand on his holstered gun, should Rydal meet opposition. Sentinel Haven follows. I notice that his hands seem to darken, pooling with shadow like curling smoke. I keep close on his heels, with Jidansa at my side and Leiron bringing up the rear. "This is the easy part," I tell myself. And I'm right. The passage curves, tracking below the observatory and beyond its bounds. There are no guards, no cameras. Nothing but the dim lights and the echo of our own feet. I wonder if this place was made specifically for Prince Bracken's children. Somehow I doubt it. The stone is old, though the walls are freshly painted the warm color of butter. It has an odd, calming effect I wouldn't expect for enemy prisoners. The Montfortins are strange indeed. About 100 yards on, the passage widens into some kind of receiving chamber, walled by a bank of windows. I balk at them, looking out onto the glimmer of the city. The windows must be thick, because I can't hear any alarms, though I still see the lights of them flashing up and down ascendant. I exchange a confused glance with Jidansa, who looks just as puzzled as I feel. She shrugs and jerks her chin to our right, where the chamber dead-ends at a single door. It is unremarkable, not even reinforced that I can see. When I lay my palm against the lock, intending to key it open again, I realize why. "Silent stone," I hiss, drawing back as if burned. Just the distant ache of the ability-smothering weapon makes my skin crawl. "Torturous bastards!" Jidansa makes a disgusted sound deep in her throat. "Those poor children! It's been months!" The others echo her sentiment. All but one. "Bad for them, good for us," Nero says without any kind of sympathy. I round on him, sneering. "What's that supposed to mean?" I growl. "Silent stone will have made them lethargic, sleepy. No one will notice when these two don't move in the morning," he says, poking at the covered bulk on Rydal's back. His fingers tap against human flesh with little regard. Right as he may be, I still scowl. "Let's get them out," I say, snapping my fingers. "Sentinel Haven, your assistance, please. And Nero, be ready to heal them. They'll need it." I know what a prison of silent stone does to a person. I saw it firsthand in Barrow. Her sunken cheeks and dull eyes, the way her bones jutted, her cold skin veined with sickness. And she was a stubborn hellion, feeding on fury to keep herself sane, with a cause to hold on to, albeit a foolish, doomed one. Prince Bracken's children are young, only 10 and 8 years old. Silvers born, reliant on their ability, with no memory of life without. I don't want to know what the Silent Stone has done to them, but I have no choice. I must look into the face of war's horrors and never blink. My father did not. My mother and sister do not. I have to keep my eyes open if I can ever hope to win. Win and go home. Laron opens this door, using his own canteen to form a watery key. It takes him a bit longer, battling the edges of Silent Stone. Finally, he swings open the door and steps back, allowing me to enter first. I shudder as I step inside, steeling myself against the unnatural sensation. It's more uniform than fighting with a silence. Their abilities pulse with their hearts and concentration. This is constant, unyielding. I swallow hard against the ugly, unnatural sensation. In spite of my team at my back, waiting in the blissful safety of the passage, I feel more vulnerable than ever, a newborn baby exposed on a cliff. The children sleep soundly, each one tucked into a nicely made bed. I glance around, expecting some kind of guard in the shadows. There's nothing but the dim silhouettes of a well-furnished room and curtained windows. As in the passage, they look out through the pines and down into the city valley. Another torture, to see the world beyond your reach. "Help me carry them out," I mutter, eager to be rid of this place. I reach for the dark-haired child in the bed closest to me, putting a hand to her face, ready to clamp my fingers over her mouth should she scream. Bracken's daughter shifts at my touch but doesn't wake. In the dim light, her skin is the color of polished jet. "Wake up, Charlotta," I murmur. My heartbeat doubles. "We need to go." Sentinel Haven is not so steady with Prince Michael. He slides one arm behind his shoulders and another under his knees before scooping him up. Like his sister, the boy is slow to wake, groggy, sluggish. The Silent Stone has wreaked its havoc upon them both. "Who?" the boy mumbles, his eyes fluttering open and shut. Beneath me, his sister stirs, roused as I shake her shoulders gently. She blinks up at me, brows knitting in confusion.
"Is it time for our walk?"
she asks, her voice high and breathy.
"We won't fuss, promise."
"Yes," I tell her quickly, seizing the opportunity. "We're going to go for a walk away from the stone, but you both have to be very quiet and do exactly as we say." It isn't a lie, and it energizes both of them as much as possible. Charlotta even wraps her arms around my neck, allowing me to lift her. She's lighter than I expected, more like a bird than a girl. She smells fresh, clean. I would think the children well-treated if not for the Silent Stone. Michael curls in Sentinel Haven's arms.
"You're new,"
he says up to the Sentinel. I can't get out of the room fast enough, and I suck in a healing breath as we step back into the passage. The children both exhale, and Charlotta relaxes in my arms. "Remember, do as we say," I mumble, averting my eyes from what Rydell and Nero have prepared. The boy nods, wordless, but the girl looks up at me with a keen glance I wouldn't expect from a child.
"Are you rescuing us?"
she whispers. I see no reason to lie. The words stick anyway, because I might fail. I might get them killed. I might die in this attempt. "Yes," I force out.
"Let me see them."
Nero wastes no time, flashing a light in both their faces that startles even me. "Quiet," I murmur when Michael yelps. I glare at Nero over the girl's head, but he ignores me, turning his focus on them. His eyes dart back and forth like some kind of ticking machine as he memorizes their features. When he turns back to the bundle on the ground, I can't look away fast enough. Still, I catch the sight of them, the two little red bodies. They are still breathing, heavily drugged, already too far gone to wake up without aid, but still breathing. Nero needs living flesh to do his work. Sentinel Haven catches my eye, and he turns as I do, putting his back to the skin healer and the reds. We can't let the children see what is being done for them, and we don't want to watch it happen. Weakness, something whispers in me when I flinch at the sound of a blade singing out of its sheath. Keep your eyes open, Iris Signet. Such artistry, I hear Nero tell himself, his voice wolfish and full of glee. His work is mostly silent. Mostly.
11. Mare. I barely slept, despite my exhaustion. It took us almost until dawn to get back to Ascendant, the healers working on us along the way. When we arrived, we only had a few hours until Davidson's planned address to his assembled government. I tried to sleep, but by the time the adrenaline from the raider battle wore off, I was racked with nerves for the coming meeting. I spent what was left of the night staring at the edges of my curtains, watching the blue light of pre-dawn grow. Now, I can barely sit still as I wait on the lower terrace, fussing with the edges of my dress. It is a harsh gown, a deep, spangled purple, belted in gold at my waist, with ballooning sleeves gathered at the wrists. The collar plunges, showing the edge of Maven's brand, and I braided my hair back away from my face. I proudly display the scars branching down my neck. My idea, not Gisa's. I want to show the Montfort politicians how much I've already sacrificed, and I want to look like as much of the Lightning Girl as I can, even if that person isn't real. I can draw strength from her, as I draw strength from Marina, too. They may be false versions of myself, but they are also pieces of someone real, however small. The sunrise is strange in the mountains. It spreads behind me, sending jagged rays of light up and over the peaks. Slowly but steadily, darkness bleeds from the valley, fleeing with the morning mist along the slopes of the city. Ascendant seems to wake up with the light, and the low hum of activity buzzes up to the palace. Queen Annabel is not one to be late, especially for something as important as this. She descends from the palace entrance, her grandson and their guards close at hand. Julian hangs back a bit, arms folded into his long golden robes. He meets my eye and nods in greeting. I return the gesture. I might not agree with his choosing to back his nephew, but I understand the choice. I understand supporting family over everything else. In her Lerilan colors, red and flaming orange, Annabel seems more like a sentinel guarding her king than his grandmother. She is just as deadly. She doesn't wear a gown, but a brocaded coat, with a matching tunic and black leggings beneath, their hems set with glinting bronze like pieces of armor. Annabel Lerilan is ready for the kind of battle not fought on the field. Her smile at me, across the terrace, does not meet her eyes. Your Majesty, I say, greeting her with a dip of my head. Tiberius, I add, my eyes flicking to him. He smirks to himself, darkly amused by my refusal to call him anything else. Not his nickname, not even his title. Good morning, he replies. He looks handsome as ever, perhaps more so. The raider battle hangs on him, and I can almost smell the ash he spent the night scrubbing away. Maybe don't think about him bathing, I snap to myself. The dawn suits the Fire Prince, in his scarlet cloak and raven silk underclothes. He has his crown on his neat black hair. Magnetron made, I bet. Another of Evangeline's creations. It suits him, too. No jewels, no intricacies. Just a simple band of raw iron sculpted like a braid of flame. I trace it with my eyes, focusing on such a small thing that he loves so much. While there is still a hissing tension between us, I don't feel the same anger or rage I did yesterday. Our words on the mountain, few as they were, had some calming effect. I wish we had more time to come to some sort of understanding. But what understanding can there be? Try as I might, I can't stamp out the hope still burning in my heart. I still want him to choose me. And I would still forgive him if he admitted his mistake. That hope refuses to die, stupid as it might be. Farley's appearance shocks me most of all. Not because her leg is healed, good as new. That I expected. She follows the immaculate Premier Davidson out, and at first I don't recognize her. Gone is the battered uniform, her dark red coveralls stained by use and worn by battle. This is a dress uniform instead, more akin to something I've seen Tiberius or Maven wear. Never Farley. I blink at her, watching her adjust the sleeves of the snug crimson coat, intimately tailored to her form. Her general's badges are fastened at the collar, three iron squares set in the fabric. There are others on her breast, medals and honors, both medal and ribbon. I doubt they're real, but they make her look impressive. Clearly, Davidson and Carmadon helped her dress for the meeting, working to legitimize the Scarlet Guard through her. Add to that the scar at the corner of her mouth and the hard steel of her blue eyes, and I wonder how any politicians might deny what she asks for. General Farley, I say, offering her a crooked smirk. Nice outfit. Careful, Barrow, before I force you into one of these two, she grumbles, fighting her sleeves again. I can barely move in this thing. The jacket runs tight across her shoulders, perfectly fitted, but not enough to allow the kind of movement she's used to, the kind of movement required in a fight. I glance at her hips, snug and equally tailored pants tucked into boots. No gun? Farley scowls. Don't remind me. To the surprise of no one, Evangeline Samos arrives last. She glides through the grand oak doors, her Samos cousins flanking her in matching gray coats and black trim. Evangeline's gown is blinding white, fading to deep, inky black at the sleeves and long train. As she grows closer, I realize that the silk of her dress isn't dyed, but patterned with chips of resplendent, shimmering metal in a perfect shift from pearly white to gray steel to black iron. She approaches with purpose, letting the gown spread behind her, hissing over the green and white stones.
If only we could replicate such an entrance in the People's Gallery, Davidson mutters to Farley and me.
He watches Evangeline approach. She squares her shoulders, letting the ramrod of determination mark her steps. The Premier himself keeps to his plain but splendid persona, clad in a dark green suit with white enamel buttons. His gray hair gleams, slicked back against his head.
Shall we? He says, gesturing to the arches leading away from the palace. In our varying colors and varying degrees of readiness, we follow him down the winding steps into the city. I wish the walk were longer, but the People's Gallery, the building where the entire Montfort government gathers for matters such as this, isn't far. Just a few hundred yards down the slope, set onto more terraces cut below the Premier's palace. Again, there are no walls to defend such an important place. Only white stone archways and sweeping verandas surround the domed building overlooking Ascendant and the valley. The sun continues to rise, gleaming off the green glass dome hundreds of feet across. The glass is too flawed to be silver-made, but it is more beautiful for the whorls and curves of imperfection, which catch the light in more interesting ways than flat, meticulous panes of pure glass. Silver-barked aspen trees with golden leaves spring up at even intervals, lining the structure like living columns. Those are the work of silvers. Green wardens, no doubt. Soldiers flank each tree, still in their dark greens. Proud, unyielding. We cross the long marble walkway to the wide-open doors of the gallery. I take a breath, steeling myself. This shouldn't be difficult. Montfort is not our enemy, and our objective is clear. Acquire an army as much as we can. Overthrow a mad king and his allies, all of them hell-bent on maintaining their power at the cost of red and new blood life. Agreeing to help should be easy for the Free Republic of Montfort. Isn't equality what they stand for? Or so I've been told. Gritting my teeth, I reach out and grab Farley's hand. I squeeze her calloused fingers just for a second. Without hesitation, she squeezes back. The first hall is columned, hung with green and white silks, gathered with silver and red ties. The colors of Montfort, and the colors of both kinds of blood. Sunlight beams down from skylights, filling the space with an ethereal glow. Many chambers branch off, visible through arches between the columns or locked behind polished oak doors. And of course, there are people in the hall, clustered together, their eyes on all of us as we pass. Men and women, red and silver, their skin a vast array of hues, ranging from porcelain to midnight. I try to feel armored in my skin, protected from their gaze. Ahead of me, Tiberius holds his head high, his grandmother on his right arm, while Evangeline takes his left. She is careful to keep in step with his long stride. No daughter of House Samos walks behind. Her gown's train forces Farley and me to keep our distance. Not that I mind. Julian walks behind us both. I can hear him muttering to himself as he looks back and forth. I'm surprised he doesn't take notes. The People's Gallery is aptly named. As we approach the entrance to the chamber, I hear the low hum of hundreds of voices. It rises quickly until it drowns out everything but the thunder of my own pulse in my ears. Massive doors of white and green enamel glide open on oiled hinges, as if bowing before the will of Premier Davidson. He enters to the cascading noise of applause. It spreads as we follow into the amphitheater that is the gallery. Hundreds crowd the many seats, ringing the room, most of them in suits like Davidson's, in varying shades of green and white. Some are military, clearly marked by dress uniforms and insignia. All rise when we enter, their hands clapping together to celebrate. Us? Or the premier? I don't know. Some don't clap, but they still stand, out of either respect or tradition. The steps down the bowl of the amphitheater are shallow. I could run them with my eyes closed. Even so, I keep my focus on my feet and the folds of my shimmering dress. Davidson reaches the floor of the chamber, making for his own seat at the center, flanked by still-standing politicians. There are empty chairs for us as well, each one marked by a drape of colored cloth. Orange for Annabelle, silver for Evangeline, purple for me, scarlet for Farley, and so forth. While Davidson greets the men and women on the floor, shaking hands with an open, charismatic grin, we take to our chairs. No matter how many times people put me on parade, I never get used to it. Not so for Evangeline. She sits next to me, arranging the falling folds of her dress with a flick of her hands. She raises an eyebrow, imperious, a living painting. She was born for moments like this, and if she is afraid of them, she will never show it. "Kill that fear, Lightning Girl," she mutters to me, fixing me with an electric stare. "It's not like you haven't done this before." "True," I whisper back, remembering Maven, his throne, and all the vile things I said at his side. This will be easy in comparison. This won't rip me apart. Davidson doesn't sit down, watching as the others in the room take their seats in thunderous unison. He clasps his hands before him, bowing his head. A lock of gray hair falls over his eyes. "Before we begin, I would like to observe a moment of silence for those who fell last night, defending our people from raider attack. They will be remembered." All over the room, his politicians and officers nod approvingly before lowering their own heads. Some close their eyes. I'm not sure which is appropriate, so I mimic the premier, knitting my fingers together and dipping my chin. After what feels like an eternity, Davidson raises his head again. "My fellow countrymen," he says, his voice carrying across the amphitheater with ease. Something about the room, I suspect, built to maximize acoustics. "I would like to thank you, both for agreeing to this special session of the People's Gallery, and for showing up." He pauses, grinning at the responding wave of polite laughter. The bland joke is an easy tool. I can pick out exactly who his supporters are, simply by how much they laugh or grin. A few politicians remain stoic. To my surprise, they are both red and silver, judging by the undertones of their skin. Davidson pushes on, pacing as he speaks.
As we're all aware, our nation is a young one, built by our own hands over the last 2 decades. I am only the 3rd premier, and many of you are in your 1st terms of office. Together, we represent the will of our diverse people and their interests, and of course, we work to provide for their safety. In the past months, I have done what I've thought is necessary to uphold what our country is and to safeguard what our country strives to be. His face turns stern, the lines on his forehead deepening. A beacon of freedom, a hope, a light in the darkness surrounding us. Montfort is a country, the only one on this continent, where the color of blood does not rule. Where red and silver and ardent work in tandem, hand in hand, to build a better future for all of our children. My knuckles turn white in my lap as I squeeze my hands together. The country Davidson speaks of, what it represents. Could it really be possible? 1 year ago, Mayor Barrow, knee-deep in the mud of the stilts, would not have believed it. Could not have. I was constrained both by what I was taught and by the only world I was allowed to see. My life was limited to the bounds of work or conscription, each a different kind of doom. Both lives already lived by thousands, millions. There was no use dreaming that life could be different. It would only break an already broken heart. It's cruel to give hope where none should be. My father told me that. And even he would never say it again. Not now, when we've seen that hope is real. And this place, this step toward a better world, is somehow real too. I see it before my eyes. Red representatives with their blooming flushes alongside silver. A new blood leader walking the floor before us. Farley, her blood red as the dawn, sitting so close to a silver king. And even me, I'm here too. My voice matters. My hope matters. I glance across Evangeline to the true king of Norta. He followed me here because he still loves me, a red girl, and because he truly does try to see things for himself. I hope he sees what I see here, and if he does take the throne, if we are unable to stop him, I hope he hears what the premier is saying. He looks at his hands, his fingers clawed on the arms of his seat. His knuckles are just as white as mine. And yet, we cannot claim to be free, we cannot claim to be any kind of beacon, if we allow atrocity on our borders. Davidson continues. He stalks toward the lower seats, gazing at each politician in turn. If we can look at the horizon and know there are Reds living as slaves, ardents slaughtered, lives crushed beneath the feet of silver overlords. The royal silvers with us do not flinch, but they don't do anything to deny what the premier is saying either. Annabelle, Tiberius, and Evangeline keep their eyes forward, their expressions locked in place. Davidson paces back, completing a circle of the floor. 1 year ago, I petitioned for the ability to interfere, to use a fraction of our armies to aid the Scarlet Guard in their infiltration of Norta, the Lakelands, and Piedmont, all kingdoms built on tyranny. It was a risk. It exposed our nation, which had been growing in secret. But you graciously agreed. He steeples his fingers, half bowing to the gallery. And so I ask again, for more soldiers, more money, for the ability to overthrow murderous regimes, and for the right to look ourselves in the face, so we can tell our children we did not stand by and watch as children just like them were murdered or condemned. It is our duty to witness and to fight now that we can. In the seats of the gallery, one of the politicians stands, a silver man with wispy blonde hair, bone-white skin, and robes of deep emerald green. His nails are oddly long and polished to a high shine.
You speak of overthrowing a regime, Premier, he says. But I see beside you a young man with silver blood and a crown upon his head. I see no other crowns in this room. And you know as well as I do, the crowns we had to destroy to forge our country, how much we had to burn to rise from the ashes.
The politician touches his own brow. His meaning is clear. One of the crowns given up was his own. I clench my teeth, fighting the urge to look at Tiberius. I want to yell at him, "See? It can be done." Davidson offers a deep bow of his head.
Very true, Representative Raddus. The Free Republic is a nation made from war, from sacrifice, and above all, things from opportunity. Before we rose up, the mountains were a patchwork of petty kingdoms and worse, fighting for dominance. There was no unity. It was easy to worm ourselves into the cracks and break apart what was already breaking.
He pauses, eyes alight.
I see a similar opportunity now. In the Silver Kingdoms of the East, room to change things in Norta, to remake things for the better.
Another politician stands from the gallery ranks, a red woman with smooth copper skin, close-cropped black hair, and a white gown crossed with an olive sash.
Does Your Majesty agree?
She asks, fixing her eyes on Tiberius. He hesitates, surprised at her directness. Tiberius isn't as quick with his words as his cursed brother.
Norta is in a state of civil war, he replies, his voice wavering. More than a third of the nation has seceded, some pledging fealty to the Kingdom of the Rift, where my betrothed's father is king.
Clenching his jaw, he gestures to Evangeline next to him. She doesn't react.
The rest are pledged to me, to putting me back on my own father's throne and casting out my brother.
A muscle jumps in his cheek.
Who murdered his way to it?
Tiberius lowers his eyes, slowly. I can see his chest rising and falling rapidly beneath the folds of his red cape.
The thought of Maven still wounds us both, Tiberius even more than me.
I was there when Maven and Alara forced him to murder his own father, the old king. I see that terrible moment written on his grim face, clear as letters in a book. The representative is not satisfied. She tips her head, bringing long fingers together.
Reports say that King Maven is beloved among the people. The ones still loyal to him, I mean, she adds. Curious that the red populace of Norta is counted in that regard.
A low current of heat ripples across my exposed skin. Not a lot, but enough to communicate Tiberius's discomfort. I curl my fingers into a fist, speaking before he is forced to.
King Maven is greatly skilled in manipulation, I tell the woman. He easily uses his own image, the boy king forced to the throne, and tricks anyone who doesn't truly know him.
And sometimes even those who do. Tiberius, most of all. He told me once he was looking for new blood whispers, stronger than Queen Alara, perhaps able to fix what she broke in his brother. An impossible wish, a terrible dream. I've seen Maven without her machinations.
She is dead, and he is still the monster she forced him to be.
The politician turns her eyes on me, and I continue. He brokered the Lakeland Alliance, ending a war my people were sent to fight. He lifted the restrictions his father made on their lives. It isn't hard to understand why he has support. It's easy to win the favor of the people you feed. As I speak, I think about myself, my family, the Stilts, Cameron, and the slum towns full of Reds trapped to their lives. Where would we be if someone had not broken through the wall around us, shown us how the world really should be? Especially when you control what they are given, both on the table and on the video screen. She grins at me, showing gapped teeth.
You've been a thorn in his side, Mayor Barrow, and a boon to him as well. We've seen videos from your capture. Your words swayed people to him, too.
The heat I feel next isn't from Tiberius, but from my own embarrassment. It claws over my face, warming my cheeks.
Yes, and I am ashamed of it,
I tell her bluntly. On my left, Farley clenches a fist on the seat of her chair. She leans forward.
You can't blame her for things said to the business end of a gun.
The red woman tightens.
I do not, of course. But your face and your voice have been used so many times, Miss Barrow. You will be little use in trying to sway your own people back in Norta. And I apologize, but it makes it difficult to trust what you say now and who you speak for.
Then speak to me, Farley snaps, her voice echoing throughout the gallery.
My flush recedes, chased away by cool relief.
I glance sidelong, more grateful for Farley than ever before. She keeps her temper in check, using it as fuel.
I am a general of the Scarlet Guard, a high officer of command. My organization has been working in the shadows for years, from the frozen shores of the Hud to the Piedmont Lowlands, and everywhere in between. We've done very much with very little. Imagine what we can do with more.
On the opposite side of the chamber, another one of the Montfort representatives puts up a hand, winking with golden rings. He's red, his smile sharp and slick.
Much, you say. Forgive me, General, but before you began working with us, your Scarlet Guard was little more than a network of allied criminals. Smugglers, thieves, murderers even.
Farley just sniffs.
We did what we had to. The Premier speaks of working through cracks. We made them. And we transported thousands out of danger. Reds who needed our help, new bloods too. Your own Premier is Norton-born, isn't he?
She points her chin at Davidson, who holds her gaze.
Nearly executed for the crime of what he was born as. We saved people like him every day.
The sly man shrugs his shoulders.
Our point is that you cannot do this alone, General, he says. And while your cause is just, accordances must be made. You are a group with no nation, no citizens to answer to. Your methods are beyond the usual bounds of war. We have our own to think of.
We answer to everyone, sir, Farley replies coolly. She turns her head just so, letting the scarred side of her mouth catch the light from the dome overhead.
Especially those who think no one is listening. We are listening, and we are doing, and we will keep fighting. To the last rattle of our last breath, the Scarlet Guard will do what it can to fix what is broken, with or without your aid.
Still pacing, Davidson passes by her. He shoots her a glance I cannot decipher, lips pressed into a neutral line, eyes locked on her face. I can't tell if he's pleased or infuriated. The silver representative named Radis stands again. He doesn't look a day over 35, and he's old enough to remember what this country was before Montfort. He eyes us all.
So you propose we support another silver monarch and help him to a throne?
On my right, Evangeline grins, and I can see she capped her eye teeth with pointed silver. Gruesome, I think to myself. And a message like the rest of her image. She will bite out the heart of anyone in her way, including all of us.
Two, actually,
she says, projecting her voice across the amphitheater.
My father, the King of the Rift, must also be recognized as a legitimate ruler.
A corner of Tiberius's mouth twitches, and Annabelle purses her lips. As before in Corvium, Evangeline does her best to sidetrack any progress her betrothed might make. Radis sneers back at her, gray eyes flashing.
But, as you told us, Premier, he says, the Free Republic was built from such kingdoms. We know what they are, what they become.
His gaze ticks from Evangeline to Tiberius. No matter how noble, how true, how honorable the king or queen. Premier Davidson's blank mask threatens to slip, betraying a frown. He bows his head slightly, acknowledging Radis's point. Others murmur around the room, ruminating on the same flaw in this alliance. Of course, Davidson and the guard have a longer game, with no intention of propping up more kings and queens, but we can't exactly argue that in front of the Silvers. The lie comes easily for me, because it isn't entirely false.
You said something else before, Premier, I say quickly, pushing out of my chair.
Before the second battle of Corvium, when we were still in Piedmont. Davidson whirls to me, an eyebrow raised.
Inches for miles, I explain, sharpening each letter on my tongue.
The full strength of the gallery's attention makes me shiver with desperation. They must agree. We need their support if we're going to end Maven's reign and stop Tiberius from picking up the crown he leaves behind. Change can be quick, or it can be slow, but the movement should always be forward. I know some of you look at King Tiberius, at Queen Annabelle and Princess Evangeline, and wonder, how are they different? How is spilling your own blood to give them a throne better than staying alive and letting Maven keep his?
Radis looks down his long nose at me. Because you claim Maven Kalor is a monster, a wayward boy with no leash.
I toss my head, flicking my braid over my shoulder. Like Farley, I let my scars tell their own story. The M on my collarbone cooks beneath 100 pairs of eyes.
Because Maven Kalor is, without question, without argument, the worse option, I say, directing my words to all of them.
Not only will he never move his country forward, but he will also drag Norda backward. He has no regard for red life or even silver, no thoughts of equality, not even an inkling of anything beyond his broken circle of vengeance and the desire to be loved. And unlike Tiberius, unlike King Volo in the Rift, unlike perhaps any silver monarch breathing today, he is willing to do anything to keep his crown.
Slowly, Radis sits. He gestures with a white hand, asking me to continue.
Not that I need his permission. Still, pride surges in me.
Yes, I tell them. Under most circumstances, you would be better off staying here, protected by your mountains, insulated against the world, if you can find it in your stomachs to ignore the atrocities of Norta and her allies.
Some of them squirm in their chairs. But not now. Not with the Lakelands on his side. You can take your time deciding whether to give us more aid, but that bell has already rung. You voted to help us before. Your soldiers were there when I was rescued from Whitefire Palace. Your army helped us hold the walls of Corvium. And Maven Kalor will never forget what you did. He will never forget how you stole me from him.
You're like Thomas was, Maven told me once. I hear him still, muttering in my head. You are the only person I care about, the only person who reminds me I am alive, not empty, and not alone. He was a monster then, keeping me trapped in his palace, trapped inside my own skin. I wonder what kind of beast he is now, with nothing and no one but the splintered pieces in his head. I grit my teeth, trying to picture his next moves. Not in the coming days, but months from now. Years.
One day, his armies will be at your door. The Nortons? The Lakelanders? They swim before my eyes. The high houses in their colors. The Lakelanders in their royal blue. All of them with all their fury, marching behind a shield of red soldiers you'll be forced to kill. You might win, but many of your own will die with them. How many? I can't say. I can only assure you it will be more. The red woman, with black hair, tips her hand, calling for attention. She looks past me, to Farley still in her seat.
Do you agree, General?
She asks, and then points to Tiberius.
Will this Silver King be better than the one already on the throne?
Farley scoffs, all but rolling her eyes.
Ma'am, I care very little for Tiberius Kalor,
she replies. I can't help but wince, hissing out a breath.
Farley.
But she isn't finished.
so you can believe me when I say he will be.
The representative bobs her head, satisfied with such an answer. She isn't the only one. Many of the politicians around the room, both red and silver, exchange whispers.
Well, Your Majesty?
The woman adds, turning her attention on Tiberius. He shifts in his chair. On his right, Annabelle touches his arm with fleeting fingers. I have enough experience with silver mothers to know that Queen Annabelle would be considered overly maternal, too gentle, too loving with her kin. I sit as he gets up, stepping onto the floor. Davidson acquiesces, finally taking his own chair to let Tiberius stand alone. He cuts a magnificent sight against the white marble and granite, and the swirling green dome over our heads. The red of his cape seems a livid flame, a swath of fresh blood. Tiberius raises his chin.
I've spent almost a year in exile, betrayed by my brother. But I was betrayed by my...
He pauses, chewing the words.
My father as well. He raised me to be a king like every king before. Unyielding, unchanging, bound to the past, locked into endless war, married to tradition.
For the first time, Evangeline flinches, her clawed nails curling on the arms of her seat. The true king pushes on.
The truth is, Norta was split in two long before my father was murdered. Silver overlords, with reds below. I knew it to be wrong, as we all know, in the deepest places of ourselves. But there are limits to the power of kings. I thought changing the bedrock of a country, rearranging the ills of our society, was one of them. I thought the current balance, however unfair, was better than the risk of tipping the kingdom into chaos.
His voice hums with determination.
And I was wrong. So many people taught me that. You were one of them, Premier,
he says, glancing back at Davidson.
And so are all of you. Your country, strange as it seems to us, is proof that new lines can be drawn, a different kind of balance can be maintained. As King of Norta, I intend to see what I couldn't before, and to do everything I can to bridge the canyons between red and silver, heal the wounds, change what must be changed.
I've heard him speak eloquently before. He did it in Corvium, saying much the same thing. He swore to change the world with us, to erase the divide between red and silver. It stirred pride in me then, but not now. I know what his words mean and exactly how far his promises extend, especially with the crown in the balance. Even so, I gasp to myself when he sinks, dropping to a knee at the center of the floor. His cape pools around him, vibrant and bloody against the marble. Murmurs rise as he bows his head.
I don't ask for anyone to fight for me, but alongside me,
he says slowly. The black-haired woman is first to speak, her head tipped to one side.
We already know you're not the kind to send another in your stead, Your Majesty,
she replies.
That was made clear last night. My daughter, Captain Via, fought with you on the Hawkway.
Still kneeling, Tiberius says nothing. He only nods, a muscle jumping his cheek. On the opposite side of the chamber, Radis gestures to Davidson, flicking out one hand. As he does so, a sudden breeze rustles through the gallery. He is a windweaver, I realize.
Put it to a vote, Premier,
the silver says. In his seat, Davidson dips his chin. He stares out, searching the many assembled politicians. I wonder what he reads in their faces. After a long moment, he exhales.
Very well, Representative Radis.
I vote yes,
Radis says quickly, firmly, and sits. On the floor, Tiberius blinks quickly, trying to mask his surprise. I feel the same. It only grows with every resounding yes, spoken from dozens of lips. I count under my breath.
30, 35, 40. There are no's scattered among the politicians, enough at first to temper any hope I might feel, but they are quickly eclipsed, drowned out, in favor of the answer we so desperately need. Finally, Davidson grins and stands back up out of his chair. He crosses the floor and touches Tiberius lightly on the shoulder, gesturing for him to rise. You have your army.
12. Evangeline. Even though Montfort is beautiful, I'm keenly glad to be leaving so soon after our arrival. What's more, I'm going home. To Ridge House, to Ptolemais, to Elaine. I'm so happy I barely notice that I have to pack up my things myself. It's the smart move. Even the Reds know it. The Rift is closer to Montfort than the Piedmont base, not to mention it isn't surrounded by Bracken's territory. And the kingdom is a place of strength, well defended. Maven won't order an assault on our lands, and we'll have time to gather our resources and our armies. Still, my skin prickles with discomfort all afternoon. I can hardly stomach Cal's grin as we step out into the courtyard of Davidson's palace. Sometimes I wish he had just an ounce of Maven's cunning, or even sense. Then he might understand what happened this morning in the People's Gallery. But no, he's too trusting, too good, and much too pleased with his little speech to realize how well Davidson maneuvers. The vote was already decided. It must have been. The politicians of Montfort already knew what Davidson would request, and they already knew how they would answer. The army was decided before we even arrived. Everything else, the entire visit to the city, was a performance and a seduction. It's what I would do. Just as Davidson's own words to me were a seduction of their own. Another small thing we allow here, he said to me when I first arrived. He knows about Elaine, and he knows exactly what to say to make me falter, make me wonder, make me think even for an instant about throwing my life away for a place here. The Premier is a good salesman, to say the least. Cal crosses the courtyard to bid goodbye to Davidson and his husband, Carmadon. Looking at the couple, I feel the familiar surge of jealousy and then nausea. I turn away, if only to look somewhere else. My eyes land on another despicable public display of emotion, another nauseating round of farewells before this troop of dancing monkeys heads to the Rift. I don't understand why Mare couldn't have said her goodbyes inside, where the rest of us didn't have to see such a performance, as if she is original in her grief, as if Mare Barrow is the only one here who has ever had to leave someone behind. She hugs her family one by one, each embrace longer than the last. Her mother cries, her father cries, her brothers and her sister cry. She does her best not to, and fails. Their half-hidden sniffles echo across the mountain jetway, and the rest of us are forced to act as if we aren't waiting for the weeping family. It's all very red, I suppose. They don't have to worry about what showing weakness might do, because for the most part, they're already weak. Someone should talk to Barrow about that. She should know by now how important maintaining an image is. The tall red boy, Barrow's tan blonde pet, follows alongside, hugging her family as if they were his own. I suppose he's still tagging along. Cal finishes with Davidson, pulling back from their whispered conversation. The Premier isn't coming back with us, not yet. Now that his government has agreed to fully aid us, he has much to organize, and he pledges to follow us back to the Rift in a week or so. But I don't think that's what they're talking about. Cal is too fervent, too on edge, his grip on Davidson tight and unyielding. His eyes are soft, though. He's asking for something, something small and unimportant to anyone but him. When the prince walks away, he passes by Mare with long, quick strides. Her brothers watch him go, eyes trailing in the prince's wake. If they were calor burners, I think they might set him on fire. The sister is less hostile, but more disappointed. She frowns at his retreating form, lip between her teeth. She looks more like Mare when she does that, especially when her frown deepens into a sneer. Cal stops at my right, settling into a wide-legged stance, crossing his arms over a plain black uniform. "You need a better mask, Kalor," I mutter to him. He only scowls. "And she needs to keep to our schedule."
"She's leaving her family behind, Evangeline," he growls in reply. "We can spare the minutes."
I heave a sigh and examine my nails. No claws today. No need for them on the journey back home. So many allowances where Barrow is concerned. I wonder where that line is and what happens when she inevitably crosses it. Instead of snarling back as I expect, he chuckles low in his throat.
"Try to spread your misery all you want, princess. It's the only thing you have left."
Gritting my teeth, I clench a fist, and I wish I'd donned my claws. "Don't pretend I'm the only one miserable here," I snap. That cows him into silence, the tips of his ears flushing a stubborn gray. With a last embrace, Mare finally finishes all her hysterical nonsense. She turns tightly, shoulders squared away from her brood. Their faces vary, but they all have a likeness. Similar coloring, dark eyes, and golden-toned skin. Dark brown hair, but for the sister and the graying parents. There's a common roughness to them, born in their blood, as if they were shaped from earth and we were shaped from stone. The red boy keeps pace as Mare walks toward us, tugged along on an invisible leash. He looks over his shoulder to wave back at the family, but Mare doesn't. I respect that instinct, at least. Her dogged and sometimes ill-advised habit of pressing forward at all costs. Cal looks up as she passes, stomping her way into the jet. His hand flexes, fingers grazing her arm as she goes. His skin is pale against the sleeve of her rust-colored jacket. But she doesn't stop, and he doesn't stop her. He only stares at her disappearing form, throat bobbing with the words he can't find it in himself to say. Part of me wants to prod him after her with a sharp knife. The rest wants to cut out that heart of his, since he insists on ignoring it and subjecting me to a similar pain.
"Shall we, my future husband?" I growl, offering him my arm. The spikes of my metallic coat lie flat, glistening against one another in invitation.
Cal eyes me darkly, his teeth clenched into a forced grin. Dutiful to the last, he slips his arm around mine, resting his hand below my wrist. His skin blazes with heat, almost too hot to touch. I feel sweat prickle on my neck, and fight the urge to shiver in disgust.
"Of course, my future wife."
How I used to want this, I don't know. Any revulsion I feel is quickly swallowed by excitement as we board the jet, our steps matched as we climb into the Iron Hulk. All that stands between me and a reunion with the ones I love most is a few short hours of flight. Squeezed alongside Cal and Mare and whatever dramatic sighs and meaningful stares they might toss at each other, yes, but I can handle it. Ptolemus is waiting. Elaine is waiting. Even thousands of miles away, I feel the cool balm of her presence, a cold towel on fevered skin. White skin, red hair, all the stars in her eyes, the moon in her teeth. When I was 13, I cut Elaine to ribbons in the training ring. For father, for even the chance of his approval. I cried for a week afterward and spent another month apologizing. She understood, of course. We know what our families are, what they demand, what we must be for them. And as the years wore on, such things became expected. Ordinary. We fought daily, hurting each other, hurting ourselves. In training, with healers at the ready, we desensitized ourselves to the necessary violence of our days. But I wouldn't do it to her now,
wouldn't hurt her for anyone on this earth, even with the best healers in the world waiting to attend her. Not for my father, or for my crown. If only Kalor felt as strongly for Mayor. If only he loved her as I love Elaine. As soon as we're safely in the belly of the jet, the curved walls lined with cushioned seats and restraints, bolted down tables and thick glassed windows, Cal peels away from me. He eases himself down next to his grandmother, holding solitary court at one of the few tabled areas.
Nanabel, I hear him mumble in greeting, using the utterly ridiculous and unbecoming pet name.
She looks weary for the first time I can remember. She offers her grandson a kind, private smile as he sits. I find a seat of my own, favoring a window and a table at the corner, where I can sleep without much disturbance. Our jet is more comfortable than the military transports, though also commandeered from the Piedmont Air Fleet. The inside is white and cheery, accented with yellow and tiny bursts of purple stars along the interior. Prince Bracken's colors and symbols. I've never met the prince, only his various diplomats through the years, and, of course, his envoys, Prince Alexandrit and Prince Darius. They're both dead now. I watched Alexandrit die in Archeon, shot through the skull during the first attempt on Maven's life. The memory turns my stomach. An Eral lord stood up, pointed a gun, and fired a bullet at the king sitting 2 feet to my left. Fired and missed, of course, forcing us to act like the allies we pretended to be. He should have died that day. I wish he'd died that day. I can still taste the iron tang of his blood, mercurial upon the stones, gushing in an open river at my feet. The assassination attempt failed. The rebelling houses fled, retreating to their lands and strongholds. Elaine is no warrior, and she was already gone, fleeing before the attack. But House Samos had to keep our cover. I still had to stand at Maven's council, stand because the weasel denied me the courtesy of a single chair, and watch him interrogate her sister. Watch his Miranda's cousin spill out her memories before they executed her for treason. Elaine never speaks of it, and I won't push. I can't imagine what I would do if Ptolemus met the same fate. No, that's not true. I can imagine 1,000 things, 1,000,000 different forms of violence and pain. And not one would fill the void. The bonds of silver blood, when strong, are unbreakable. Our loyalty to the few we love runs bone deep. What will Bracken do for his children, then? I didn't ask after them, or their treatment in Montfort. It's easier not to. One less worry in a world full of worries. My pursuit of silent privacy is interrupted by a hurricane of muscular limbs and cropped blonde hair. The Scarlet Guard general sits with a collapsing thump, shuddering the floor beneath my feet. You move with the grace of one of those bison, I sneer, hoping to chase her out of the seat opposite mine. She doesn't flinch or reply. The woman just glares at me with a flash of anger, her eyes galaxy blue. Then she turns to the window, leaning her forehead against the glass with a low huff of breath. She isn't crying. Not like Barrow, who enters the jet with hiccups and red-rimmed eyes. There is no such display of sorrow on General Farley. Still, I can see the agony rolling off her like a tide. Her face goes blank, empty without the usual stony expression and obligatory disgust she tosses at Silvers, especially me. I know she has a daughter, an infant, stowed away somewhere. Not here, not on this craft. Barrow follows the red woman, taking the seat beside her, and I snarl to myself. We traveled here with 2 jets, enough to keep the reds and silvers apart, as well as carry the bounty of Corvium. I find myself wishing that were still the case, and we weren't all crammed together for the journey to the rift. There are approximately 60 other seats on this plane, I mutter. Mare cuts her own glare at me,
torn between anger and heartache. "You're welcome to move if you want," she replies, "but I doubt you have somewhere better to sit." She gestures with her chin, indicating the rest of the plane as it fills with various representatives of those loyal to Cal and the Scarlet Guard. I sink back into the plush seat, almost huffing. She isn't wrong. I hardly want to spend the hours donning a court mask, wielding a smile like a shield to trade information and veiled threats with the other Silvers. Nor do I have any desire to shut my eyes among Reds who would rather slit my throat. No. Strangely, Mare Barrow is my safest haven here. Our bargain protects us both. Mare shifts her attention, moving so her body is squared to the general. They don't speak, and Diana Farley doesn't look at Barrow. Her focus on the window is perfect, enough to shatter the glass. She doesn't seem to notice when Mare takes her hand. As the jet purrs to life, its engines humming to a roar, she doesn't move. Her teeth clench, the muscles in her jaw jumping as she grinds them together. Only when we take off, climbing into the clouds, leaving the mountains behind, does she shut her eyes. I think I hear her whisper goodbye. I'm the first down the steps of the jet, gulping the fresh scent of the rift in summer. I smell dirt and river and leaves and damp heat, undercut with a distant hint of iron beneath the hills. The sun is strong, bright in a hazy, humid sky. It makes everything gleam in odd contrast. The ridges march off into the distance, lush and green against the flat, hot black of the paved runway. If I were to lay a palm to the ground, it would burn my skin. Waves of heat distortion rise from the pavement, wobbling the world around me. Or that could just be me, trembling with want. I try not to run, try to hold on to some sense of propriety. My relationship with Elaine Haven is an open secret now, and a small one in comparison to the myriad of alliances and betrayals that seem to tangle our lives in so many webs. A small secret, but a shameful one. An obstacle. A difficulty. Inorta. In the rift, a voice says in my head, not so elsewhere. She won't be waiting out here for all to see. It's not her way. Still, my heartbeat hammers, pounding at my pulse points. Ptolemus is not so restricted. He stands on the runway, sweating stubbornly in a summer uniform of gray linen and reserved regalia. The only metal on him winks at his wrists. Thick braided iron rope, more weapon than jewelry. A caution, especially alongside the dozen or so guards in Samos colors. A few are cousins, marked by their silver hair and black eyes. The rest are pledged to our house, to my father's crown, in the same way Maven's guards were. I don't bother noting their colors. They don't matter.
Eve,
he says, opening his arms to me. I return the gesture, holding him around the middle, letting all the muscles in my body release for one long moment of relief. Ptolemus is safe and whole beneath my fingertips, solid, real, alive. Now, more than ever, I won't take that for granted. Tali, I breathe in reply, pulling back to look up at him. The same relief I feel flashes in his stormy eyes. We despise being parted. It's like separating a sword from a shield. I'm sorry I left. No, you didn't leave him. That denotes choice. You had no choice in this. My fingers tighten on my brother's upper arm. Father sent me to Montfort to send a message, not just to our coalition, but to me. He is my king and lord of my house. It is my duty to obey him, to go where he wishes, do as he says, and marry who he commands, live as he wills. But I see no other way, no other path than the one he sets.
Sad to miss the chaos, Ptolemus says, pushing me back softly. Father's gone a bit wild making up a proper court, silver all over the place, and he can't decide on a throne.
What about Mother? I ask, tentative.
Despite the heat, Ptolemus tucks my arm under his, leading me toward our transport. Behind us, others fall in line, but I have little regard for them.
More of the same, he says, prodding after grandchildren. She escorts Elaine to my rooms every night. I think she might even stand guard outside the door.
Bile rises in my throat, but I force it down. And? I tried to keep my voice from wavering. His grip tightens.
We do as we all agreed.
His breath catches.
What has to be done for this to work?
Hot green envy roars in my chest. I thought I wouldn't be jealous. Months ago, when all three of us came to this decision, when we decided to go through with Elaine's betrothal to my brother. At first, the betrothal was simply meant to protect her, take her out of consideration for any other houses until we could figure something out. It would not do to have her married off to some simpering well green warden or boorish Rombo strong arm. Both out of my reach and out of my control. She is a beautiful girl, a talented shadow. Her house is of great value, and Ptolemus is the heir to House Samos. It was an equal match. Understandable, predictable, useful for a time. When the three of us thought there were no other options, I was still betrothed to Maven, doomed to be his queen. But Ptolemus was near as his right hand, close to court. A marriage would keep Elaine close to. We didn't know what machinations our father had in store. Not really, not the details. If I knew then what I know now, what decisions would have been different? Ptolemus would be unwed, an eligible prince, and Elaine free to follow you, her princess, wherever you may go, to marry whatever courtier you chose, not chained to your brother in another kingdom, another country, another bedroom, for the rest of all your lives. Father could have stopped us, but he didn't. He let us make this mistake. I bet he enjoyed it, knowing I was separating myself from the one person I wanted more than any crown. Eve, Ptolemus whispers, bending down. He's at least 6 inches taller than me, broader, too. The firstborn, 4 years my elder. The son of Volos Samos, the heir to the kingdom of the Rift. I love my brother, but his life will always be easier than mine, and I'm allowed to resent him for it in my small way. It's fine, I force out between clenched teeth. It's a good thing I'm not wearing my usual medals, or they all might crush to dust. Out of the corner of my eye, I note Tali adjusting his bracelets as they tighten on his skin. We chose this. We have to live with it. The odd, faraway voice rises again. Do you? In my mind, I see a flash of a white suit and a green one. Two men, their hands different colors, fingers interlaced. They cloud across my vision, and I rely on Ptolemus to lead me the last few steps. He almost has to lift me into the transport. The vision of Davidson and Carmadon is replaced with another. My brother and Elaine in a familiar bedroom. My own wretched mother's shadow at the door. There's only one way to erase the vision threatening to burn itself onto my eyes. While the rest make for the newly fashioned throne room to greet my father as a king deserves, I do the opposite. I know Ridge House as well as my own face, and it isn't difficult to slip away in the receiving courtyard, disappear into the regimented trees and flowers. The servant's garden connects to the kitchens, and I barely notice the reds as I pass. They shrink from my presence, well accustomed to my moods. Currently, I feel like a storm cloud, dark and brooding, threatening to burst. Elaine waits in my room, our room, the windows clear, curtains open. She knows I like the sun, especially on her. She perches in one of the window seats, leaning back against a pillow, one leg dangling free, bare to her upper thigh beneath a sheer black gown. She doesn't turn to look at me when I walk in, allowing me the time I want to adjust to her presence. My eyes trace her leg before jumping to her hair, red and gleaming, loose around her pale shoulders. It looks like liquid fire, Her skin seems to glow, because it does. This is her ability, her art. She manipulates the light just so, accentuating herself without any need for makeup or finery. Rarely do I feel ugly. I'm a beautiful girl, by design and nature. But after the long flight, without my usual armor of an intricate dress and painted face, I feel diminished next to her, unworthy. I fight the urge to duck into my bathroom and sweep a little makeup on. Finally, she turns, giving me full view of her face. Again, I feel a little bit of shame in coming to her so disheveled. But want quickly chases away any other sensation. She laughs as I kick the door shut and cross the room to take her face in my hands. Her skin is smooth and cool beneath my fingers, a perfect alabaster. Still, she doesn't speak, letting me look over her features. "No crown," she says, raising her hand to my temple. "No need for it. They all know who I am." Her touch brushes lightly, sweeping down my cheekbone as she tries to smooth away my cares. "Did you sleep on your journey back?" I huff, running my thumbs along the underside of her jaw. "Is that your way of saying I look tired?" Her fingers continue over my face, down to my neck. "I'm saying you can sleep if you want." "I've slept enough." She smirks, lips twisting in the split second before I kiss her. It breaks my heart to know she isn't really mine. A fist collides with my door, pounding directly on the entrance to my bedroom. Not even the salon outside where visitors are meant to wait. My bedroom, our bedroom, directly. I shoot up from my pillows, untangling myself from the sheets with fury. With a flick of my wrist, I draw a knife from the chest across the room and make quick work of the silk twisting around my legs. Elaine doesn't blink when the blade passes within an inch of her bare skin. She just yawns, my lazy cat, and rolls over to cradle a pillow. "So rude," she murmurs, meaning both me and whatever idiot decided to interrupt us. "Practicing for that foul creature," I reply, cutting the last sheet. "What an unlucky messenger." I stand naked before tying a soft robe around myself with the blade still in hand. The knocking continues, followed by a muffled voice. I recognize it, and some of my delicious, righteous anger evaporates. "No scaring the colors out of anyone right now." Annoyed, I throw the knife at the wall. It sticks, blade sinking into the woodwork. "What, Ptolemus?" I sigh, wrenching open the bedroom door. He looks similarly disheveled, his hair messy and his eyes burning. I suspect he was interrupted as I was. He and Ren Skonos like their afternoon trysts. "We're needed in the throne room," he says firmly, "right now." "Is father that upset I haven't kissed his feet yet? It's only been a few minutes." "It's been 2 hours," Elaine calls, not bothering to raise her head. "Hello, husband," she adds, tipping a dainty hand. "Be a dear and call for some lunch?" I tighten the robe, annoyed. "So what am I walking into? A public lashing? Will he finally make good on the promise to spike our heads to the gate?" I sneer, chuckling darkly. "Strangely, this isn't about you," my brother replies, his voice sharp and dry. "There's been an attack." Quickly, I look over my shoulder. Elaine lies sprawled, partially covered by the sheets. She isn't glowing now, without any reason to concentrate as she drifts back to sleep. She is defenseless, vulnerable, even to words. "Out here," I mutter, pushing my brother into the adjoining salon. "I can protect her from this, at least, if nothing else." I lead him to one of the couches, a cool green to match the hilly vista in the window. Rough river stone paves the floor, strewn with soft blue carpets. "What happened? Attack where?" For some reason, I picture Montfort, and my heart plunges in my chest. Ptolemus doesn't sit. He paces instead, hands on his hips, the tendons in his forearms flex. "Piedmont." I can't help but scoff. "Maven's a fool," I snarl. He's only hurting Bracken's resources, not ours. I didn't think he was this stupid.
Maven didn't hit Bracken, my brother snaps. Bracken hit us, the Piedmont base, 2 hours ago, but we just got the call for help.
What? I blink, admittedly confused. I raise a hand, clutching the collar of my robe, pulling it shut. As if silk can save me from anything.
He cut off the base, stormed it with his own army and an alliance of the other Piedmont princes. He's taking it back, killing anyone they could get their hands on. Norton Red, Montfort Silver, New Bloods.
Ptolemus prowls to the window, putting a hand to the glass. He stares east at the haze of a hot afternoon.
We suspect Maven and the Lakelands are helping behind the scenes.
I look at the floor, my bare feet on the carpet. But his children, Montfort will have to kill them. What a trade. Your children for your crown. I wonder if my own father would make the same choice. Slowly, Ptolemus shakes his head.
We received word from Montfort, too. The children, they're gone. Replaced with red corpses healed to look like Princess Charlotta and Prince Michael. Someone got to them and got them out.
He growls low in his throat.
Montfort idiots don't know how it happened. How anyone got into their precious mountains and out again.
I wave a hand, dismissing the point. It doesn't matter right now. So Piedmont is finished?
His jaw tightens. Piedmont is with Maven now.
And what can we do? I suck in a dragging breath. My mind whirls. There was a garrison left back in Piedmont. Soldiers from the Scarlet Guard and Montfort. Red, New Blood, and Silver. People we need for our armies. I grip my teeth, wondering how many might have survived. At least my father's own army is here in the Rift, having returned after we destroyed Corvium. The same can be said of Annabelle's alliance. Our silver strength is preserved, but the loss of the base and Piedmont will have devastating consequences. I swallow hard, my voice shaking as I speak again. What can we do against the Lakelands, Maven's Norda, and Piedmont? My brother's look is grim, and I shiver to my core.
We're about to find out.
13. Iris. I've never been this far south. The Piedmont base is so thick with humidity, I feel as if I could weaponize the air itself. My bare arms prickle with the sensation of moisture, minuscule droplets too small to see dancing over my skin. I stretch a little, moving my fingers in tiny circles, stirring up the cloying warmth hanging over the balcony of the base headquarters. Thunderheads chase across the horizon, trailing gray shadows of lashing rain out over the swamps. Lightning forks once or twice, and the distant rumble takes 4 or 5 seconds to reach us. The light breeze smells of fires doused by the passing rain, then smoke trails over near the main gate of the base. Bracken's own soldiers marched in through open gates before turning on all inside in a blitz of swift and strong arm, revealing exactly where their bought allegiances lie. With Maven, and with me. The King of Norda lays his bone-white hands flat on the balcony railing, leaning forward an inch or two over the edge. It isn't far to the ground, just 2 stories. If I pushed him over the rail, he would live, albeit with a few broken bones. He squints, dark brow furrowed beneath a simple crown of iron and ruby. No cloak today, too hot. Instead, he has his usual black uniform, unbuttoned at the throat, the fabric flapping in the slight damp breeze. A sheen of sweat gleams on his neck. Not from the heat. A Fire King would be far more comfortable than anyone else at these temperatures. The sweat isn't from exertion, either. He took no part in the storming of the base. Neither did I, though both our nations provided silver soldiers for Bracken's endeavor. We waited until it was clear, until victory was sure, before setting foot here. I think Maven is nervous, afraid, and enraged. She wasn't here. I watch him quietly, waiting for him to speak. His throat works, bobbing between the open folds of his collar. He looks oddly vulnerable, in spite of our triumph.
"How many escaped?"
he asks without meeting my gaze. His eyes stay fixed on the storm. I bite back a rush of annoyance. I'm not some lieutenant, some officer's aide meant to stand and give figures. But I tell him what he wants, and I do it with a tight smile. 100 into the swamps, I reply, running a hand through the flowers blooming from boxes along the balcony. The dirt around them is still wet from the passing rains, and a particularly exuberant gardener. Behind us, more flowering vines run up the brick walls and columns of the administrative building. The Piedmontese love their flowers. They explode in various shades, thriving in this climate. White, yellow, purple, pink, and a bit of comforting blue. The sun strengthens overhead, and I wish I'd worn white instead of my royal blue dress. The linen is light, at least, thin enough that I can feel the wind on my skin. Maven plucks a single indigo bloom from the flowers at his side.
And another 200 dead.
Not a question. He knows the death toll well enough. They're being identified now to the best of our ability. He shrugs.
Use the prisoners. Perhaps a few will do the work for us.
I doubt that, I reply. The Scarlet Guard and the Montfortins are loyal creatures. They won't do a thing to help us. With a long, low sigh, he straightens up, pushing back from the balcony. He squints as another crack of lightning flashes, closer this time. What little color he has left drains from his face when the sound of thunder rolls over us. Is he thinking of the Lightning Girl?
I have some Miranda's cousins who could be the judge of that.
I grit my teeth. You know how I feel about whispers, I say too quick and too harsh. His mother was one, I remind myself, bracing for some kind of reprimand. But Maven remains silent. He lays the flower on the railing, petals up, and fusses with his fingernails. They're short, worn by teeth and anxiety. I would expect a king to keep his nails finely manicured, suited to the arms of a throne. Or maybe roughed by training or combat, as I'm sure his brothers are. Not ruined by nervous habits better suited to a child. And I think I know how you feel as well, Maven, I hear myself say, daring to turn over one of my many cards on the table. Again, he doesn't respond, and I know I'm right. Whatever his mother did, however her whispers crawled across his brain, left scars and marks. He doesn't want to risk more. I sense a chink in his armor, a hole in the wall he keeps up. What if I could slip through? If I could grab hold of a piece of him, the way Mare Barrow has, could I hold the reins of a king? We can remove them from court if you want, I murmur slowly. I school my features into something softer, more caring, as I shift closer to him. I angle my body so my collarbone juts out, and my dress slips just so, showing exactly as much skin as I need. Blame it on me, my Lakeland superstitions. Call it a short-lived measure to please your new wife. It's like circling a whirlpool, trying to keep to its edges, to stay within its bounds without drowning. The corner of his mouth lifts, tugging his lips. He cuts a sharp profile, all edges of straight nose, proud brow, and sculpted cheekbones.
You're 19, aren't you, Iris?
I blink at him, confused. And? Grinning, he moves faster than I expect, putting one hand to my face. I flinch as his fingers slide behind my ear, his thumb beneath my chin. The latter digs a little, pressing into the flesh of my throat. His skin flares, hot but not burning. We're almost the same height, but he is an inch or so over me, and I'm forced to look up into eyes like a tundra sky. Frozen, unforgiving, endless. To anyone watching, we might look like enamored newlyweds.
You're very good at this already, he says, his oddly cool breath washing over my face. But so am I.
I step back, meaning to pull from his grip, but he releases me before I force any kind of struggle. He seems amused, which makes my stomach churn. I give no indication of my disgust, only cold indifference. I raise an eyebrow and smooth my hair over one shoulder, gleaming black and oil-smooth. I try to channel my mother's regal, fearless nature. Touch me without my consent again, and we'll see how long you can hold your breath. Slowly he lifts the flower again, and his fist tightens around it. One by one the petals fall, and he flicks his wrist, sparking his bracelet. The petals burn before they hit the ground, disappearing in a burst of red flame and ash and open threat.
Forgive me, my queen, he says, smiling. Lying. The stress of this war can be such a ruin on my nerves. I only hope my brother can be made to see reason, and the traitors with him are brought to justice, so we might finally have some peace in our lands.
Of course. My words are just as false as his. I dip my head, ignoring any shame I feel in the action. Peace is the goal we all share. After my mother feasts on your country and tosses your throne into the ocean, after we bleed the Samos king dry and kill every person responsible for my father's death, after we take your crown, Maven Kalor, and drown you and your brother both.
Your Majesty!
We both turn to find one of Maven's sentinels, his mask black and glittering, standing in the doorway at the balcony. He bows low, his robes a swirl of woven fire. I can't imagine how sweltering their armor and robes must be right now. Maven gestures, hands open. His voice is a bucket of ice water.
What is it? We've located what you asked for.
I can only see the sentinel's eyes beneath his mask, and they flash with fear.
Are you sure?
The king picks at his nails again, feigning disinterest. This only piques mine. The sentinel bobs his head.
Yes, sir.
With a cutting smile, Maven looks up from his hands and turns, putting his back to the railing.
Well then, my thanks. I'd like to see it. Yes, sir,
the sentinel says again, nodding once more.
Iris, care to join me?
Maven asks, one hand outstretched. His fingers hover half an inch from my arm, taunting me. Every warrior instinct I have tells me to refuse, but then I openly admit I am afraid of Maven Kalor and give him power over me. This I cannot allow. And whatever he's looking for on the Piedmont base could be important to the Lakelands. A weapon, perhaps. Intelligence, maybe. Why not? I say with an exaggerated shrug. I ignore his hand, following the sentinel off the balcony. My dress snaps behind me, cut low to show the whirls of water tattooed across my back. The base is a good size, though half as big as the major citadels where we house our fleets and armies back in the Lakelands. Wherever we're going must be close enough to walk, as Maven's contingent of sentinels doesn't bring a transport. I wish they would. Despite the many trees dotting the streets of the base, the shady areas aren't much cooler than the sunlit streets. As we walk, flanked by a dozen sentinel guards, I run a hand along my neck. Droplets of water form in the wake of my fingertips, each one running a soothing race down my inked spine. Maven follows close at the heels of his lead sentinel, hands fisted in his pockets. He's eager. He wants whatever we're about to find. They turn us onto a street of row houses. At first it seems oddly cheerful. Red brick and black shutters, paved sidewalks, flowers blooming and columns of pruned trees. But the emptiness is unsettling, like a city block removed of its inhabitants. A dollhouse without dolls. The people who lived here were either killed or captured, or they fled into the stinking, sinking swamps. Perhaps they left something of value behind.
These were officer homes, one of the sentinels explains. Before the occupation.
I raise an eyebrow at him. And after?
Used by the enemy. Red rats, blood traitors, new blood freaks.
One of the sentinels hisses behind his mask. Maven stops so quickly his leather boots leave black scuff marks on the sidewalk. He turns to the hissing guard, hands still concealed. Despite the sentinel's towering height, Maven doesn't seem at all perturbed. In fact, he wears no expression at all as he stares.
What was that, Sentinel Rhombus?
Strong arm. The sentinel could tear Maven's arms off if he wanted. Instead, his eyes widen behind his mask, a watery brown full of terror.
Nothing of importance, Your Majesty. I decide what is important, Maven clips. What did you say? I answered Her Majesty the Queen.
His eyes shift to me, begging for some kind of protection, but I have none to give. The sentinels are Maven's to command.
I told her Reds lived here during the Montfort occupation. And Silvers. And New Bloods. Rats. Traitors. Freaks.
Maven offers, still without any inflection or emotion. I almost wish he would explode with rage. This is far more frightening. A king who cannot be read, a king without anything in him.
Those were your exact words, weren't they? They were, Your Majesty.
With a crack of his neck, Maven looks at another guard.
Sentinel Osanos, can you explain why this was a mistake?
The blue-eyed nymph sputters at my side, stunned to be called upon. She tries to gather herself as quickly as possible, and answer correctly.
Because...
She trails off, her fingers twitching in her robes. I can't say, sir. His hum is low, guttural, vibrating in the damp air.
No one.
I truly despise him. I click my tongue. Because Sentinel Rhombus insulted Mayor Barrow in your presence. I suddenly regret wishing Maven would show anger instead of emptiness. His eyes go black, the pupils blowing out in fury. His mouth opens a little, showing teeth, though I expect fangs. The sentinels around us tense, and I wonder if they would try to stop him if he moved to strike me. I don't think they would. I'm their charge as well, but he comes first. He will always come first in this marriage.
My wife has such an imagination,
he sneers, though I've struck upon the truth, an ugly one. I knew he was obsessed with her, in love with her in some corrupt and vile way, but his reaction hints at something deeper, an internal flaw of someone else's making. His mother did this to him, for a reason I can't fathom. Speared the pain and agony and torture of loving Mare through his heart and brain. In spite of my better instincts, I feel the smallest pang of pity for Maven Kalor. He is not of his own making, not entirely. Someone else perfectly cut him apart and poorly put him back together. His anger passes like the storm clouds, leaving the threat of trembling thunder in its wake. The sentinels relax when it does. Maven rolls his shoulders and smooths a hand through his hair.
Your mistake, Sentinel Rhombus, lies in your disdain, he says,
his voice returning to the dismissive, boyish tone he uses to ensnare people. Stepping lightly, he gets us moving again, though I think the sentinels are keeping a distance.
We are at war, yes, and these people are our enemies, but they're still people. Many of them my rightful subjects and your own countrymen. When we claim our victory, we will welcome them back into the kingdom of Norta. With some exceptions, of course, he adds with a conspiratorial smirk.
The lie comes so easily and so well, I shiver in the heat.
Here, sir,
one of the guards finally says, indicating a row house that looks identical to the others at first glance. But upon closer inspection, I realize the flowers are better tended to. Vibrant, lush petals and verdant green leaves burst from the window boxes. Maven glares up at the windows as if inspecting a corpse. He mounts the steps to the door, moving slowly.
And what freak lived here? He finally says.
At first, the sentinels do not answer, fearing the trap for what it is. Only Osanos is brave enough to speak. She clears her throat, then responds. Mayor Barrow. Maven nods, still for a second. Then he raises a foot, slamming his boot next to the doorknob, kicking the lock and the door open with a shatter of wood. His form recedes like a fading shadow as he enters the house. I remain on the pavement for a moment. Stay here. The sentinels hesitate with me, reluctant to follow their king. Though I would personally love nothing more than an assassin to jump out of a closet and cut Maven's throat, I know how that would destroy any chance of winning this war and keeping the Lakelands safe from the other brother and his pets in the rift. Keep up, I growl, ascending the steps after my foul husband. The sentinels clatter after me, their armor clinking beneath their robes of flame. I focus on the sound of them as we enter the dim house, empty and silent without its occupants. The walls are oddly bare. Bracken did say his base, and many of his own treasures, were stripped of valuables, sold off for resources. I wince at the thought of my own home facing such vultures, our shrines and temples desecrated to fund a war. Not while I live and breathe, not while Mother holds her throne. I don't bother entering the small salon or searching out the kitchen. Maven's footsteps echo on the stairs, and I follow, pulling the sentinels along with me. If the king wants to be alone, he doesn't say so. He bangs open each door on the second floor in turn, poking his head into various bedrooms, closets, and the bathroom. Once or twice, he snarls under his breath, like a predator denied prey. At the final door, in the corner, he pauses, hesitating. This door he opens with one hand, gently, as if entering a holy place. I hang back a moment, letting him go first. Inside is a bedroom with two small beds flanking a single window. I notice the oddity first. The patterned curtains are cut up, with precise chunks removed. The sister, Maven murmurs, running his hand along a sliced edge. The seamstress. As he runs the fabric through his fingers, sparks spit from his wrist. They catch and spread, eating through the curtains with speed and skill. Burning holes spread like disease. Acrid smoke stings my nostrils. He does the same to the wallpaper, letting it burn and peel beneath his touch. Then the window, laying a flaming hand to the glass. It cracks under the tremendous heat he throws off, shattering outward into the sunlight. The room seems to pulse and boil, like the inside of a bubbling pot. I want to step away, but I want to see him, Maven. I must know who he is if I am to defeat him. The first bed he ignores, somehow knowing it wasn't hers. The second he sinks into, as if testing the firmness. He smooths the coverlet beneath his hands, then the pillow, feeling where her head used to rest. I almost expect him to lie down and breathe in whatever scent might linger. Instead, his fire consumes feather and fabric, wood frame. It leaps across to the other bed, gobbling it up.
Give me a minute, please,
he whispers, almost inaudible over the roar of controlled flame. We do as we are told, fleeing before the shining heat. A minute is all he needs. We're barely back on the street before he emerges from the door, an inferno jumping to life behind him. I realize I'm sweating with fear as we walk away, and the row house crumbles. What will Maven burn next? The snarl of transports echoes outside the holding bunker. The soldiers must have returned, and I wonder if they managed to track down anyone in the swamps. The noise filters through the high windows cut into the concrete slab walls. This room is cool, partially underground, bisected by a long aisle dividing two rows of barred cells. By the official count, we have 47 captured held here, two or three to a cell, all red-blooded, but still under heavy silver guard. Some could be new bloods, quietly waiting for a chance to use their abilities and escape. The Silvers of Montfort, the blood traders, as the sentinel called them, are being held elsewhere, restrained by silence and the most powerful of guards. Maven idly knocks his knuckles against each bar we pass. The prisoners shrink back or stand firm, afraid or defiant in the face of the King of Norta. Strange, he seems relaxed here, surrounded by cells. He barely seems to notice the prisoners at all. I do the opposite. I count as we go, to see if they match the official tally, to look for any flash of rebellion or determination that might spark into something inconvenient. I wish I could separate red from new blood. Every cell I pass makes me uneasy, knowing a snake could be waiting in each one. At the far end of the bunker, another contingent of royal silvers approaches, their colors yellow, white, and purple. All done up in gold armor and weapons, better suited to decorating a banquet hall. Prince Bracken smiles broadly, but the children clutching his hands cower. Michael and Charlotta alternate between burying their faces in their father's purple-spangled robes and looking at their golden-shod feet. While I feel a surge of sorrow for the children and what they endured at the hands of the Montfort monsters, I am also grateful to see that they are well enough to accompany their father. When we slipped out of the Mountain Kingdom with them, they could barely speak, despite the wretched healer's fine work. For no skin healer can mend a mind. If only they could, I think to myself, glancing sidelong at my husband.
Prince Bracken, Maven says, dipping his head with all the charm he can muster.
Then he sinks further, to eye level with the approaching children.
And Michael, Charlotta, the bravest pair of siblings I ever saw.
Michael hides his face again, but Charlotta offers the smallest of smiles, the polite kind, hammered into her by some etiquette instructor, no doubt. Very brave indeed, I add, winking at the pair of them. Bracken stops before us, still smiling, and his guards and retainers glide to a halt with him. I spot another Piedmont prince in their midst, marked by a crown of emeralds, but I can't say which one.
Your Majesties,
Bracken offers, sweeping out his hands to bow as low as he can. His children, still holding his fingers, do the same with practiced grace. Even shy, shivering little Michael.
There are neither enough words nor enough gold in the world to express my gratitude. But rest assured, you have it.
The prince's eyes stray to me, and I meet his gaze, raising my chin. I saved his children with my own two hands. That will not be forgotten.
Just as you have use of my military installation, and any resources Piedmont can offer in this war against the very nature of our world.
With a flick of his fingers, Maven gestures for Bracken to stand.
You have my gratitude as well for such a mighty pledge,
Maven replies, all performance and posture.
Together we can end what my brother began.
Something flashes in Bracken's eye, amusement maybe. Does he see the lie for what it is? Tiberius Calor did not start this war, not by any stretch of the imagination. That sin lies with the Red Rebels. I swallow, my throat suddenly dry. The Scarlet Guard began in the Lakelands, spurred on by necessary actions my own father took. Still, if they are sinners, we enabled their existence, allowing it to spread. We share in the sin and shame.
Together with the Lakelands, Bracken adds.
Another flash of amusement in the prince, and I feel heat rise in my cheeks. Of course. We back Maven Calor to the last. With as little as we can afford to send, fewer troops, less weaponry, less money. The rest of it jealously guarded and hoarded for when we need it most. My cheek burns, flaming hot, as Maven's lips brush my face in a chaste but symbolic kiss.
We're a good match, aren't we?
He says, turning back to Bracken. I fight the urge to make good on my promise and pin Maven to the floor where I can drown him to my heart's content.
Quite,
Bracken murmurs, his black eyes darting between us.
Unfortunately, we don't seem to be making much headway. I've sent for whispers and singers from Prince Deniarde's lands.
He gestures to the prince behind him, resplendent in his emeralds and sheer green silk.
But they've yet to arrive. and I'm afraid I don't want to risk further damaging any of the prisoners before they can be properly interrogated.
I turned to the nearest cell, hoping to hide my disgust at the thought of whispers and singers coming here. Neither should be trusted, but I hold my tongue. A man in the cell stares back at me, his eyes like bright coals in the dim light of his prison. His skin is as brown as mine, although with a reddish undertone, and his black hair is curly, as is his oiled and groomed beard. The uniform he wears is dark green, the color of Montfort. It has rips in it, missing patches on the breast and upper arms. They dangle broken thread. From insignia removed, badges and honors torn away. I narrow my eyes, and he does the same.
"What's your rank, soldier?" I sneer, crossing to the bars.
Behind me, Bracken and Maven quiet. The bearded man says nothing. As I come closer, I realize he has a scar below his eye. Too uniform to be an accident. A well-heeled and perfectly straight line. I jerk my chin at it.
"Someone gave you that mark, didn't they?"
"You speak as if a silver holding me down and scarring my face were a gift," he replies slowly.
His words are oddly stilted, broken apart, as if he has to think through each as it weighs on his tongue. I trace the scar again, looking it over. I wonder what he did, or didn't do, to warrant such a punishment.
"When your whispers come," I say, looking over my shoulder to Bracken, "start with him. He's of higher rank. He'll know more than most."
Maven's lips twitch, and he almost smiles.
"Of course," Bracken replies. "We'll start with that foolish Red, won't we?"
he adds, crooning to his children as he leads them away. They nod in tandem, seeming far younger than 10 and 8.
"Then you'll see they are nothing to be frightened of, not anymore. They're nothing to you, nothing."
Again, Michael hides his face, shoving his head under his father's arm. Charlotta does the opposite, putting her tiny chin in the air. She has freckles, a dusting over her brown skin. In Montfort, her hair was simple, smoothed back into a single, tight knot. Here, she dresses like the princess she is, in patterned white silk, with amethysts studding her many braids. I watch her as she follows her father, small gown trailing over concrete. Her outfit reminds me of a bride's dress, and I wonder who she will be traded to, as I was traded, when the time comes. We continue on our way, surveying the cells, and I return to my counting. Maven swings his arms back and forth, almost joyful. So the victory has had an effect after all. "I didn't know you were capable of happiness," I mutter, and he laughs outright. It cuts like glass. He grins at me unkindly, a wild, manic gleam in his eye.
"Your impression of Mayor Barrow is very good."
I sneer back, dancing on the knife edge.
"Well, you want her to be your queen, so I might as well play the part."
Another peal of laughter. He blinks at me, as if inspecting a painting.
"Is this jealousy, Iris?"
I tighten under his scrutiny, my muscles tense as coiled wire.
"No, no, it's not," he sighs, still smiling. "As I said before, we're a good match."
"Hardly."
"Did someone say my name?"
Maven stops short next to me, his brows furrowing in open confusion. He tips his head to one side and looks over his shoulder, blinking at the cell behind us. The voice belongs to a bearded man. He leans against his bars, dangling his hands into the central aisle. He peers at us, an eyebrow raised like some kind of challenge.
"You heard me, Maven," he says.
And his voice is different from before. Still his own, but stronger, faster, more forceful. A sharp edge on stone. We look back at him, perplexed. At least I am. Maven looks torn between murderous fury and hope? The man grins.
"Have you missed me?" he says. "I think you have."
I hear bone on bone, grinding teeth. Maven clenches his jaw and forces out a single word.
Mare.
14. Mare. He knows it's you. We all seem to inhale at the same time, and my breath feels ragged. Suddenly, the small room tucked away in the Samos Palace is much too tight. On instinct, my eyes snap to Farley. She stares back at me. Her throat works, swallowing hard, and I trace the action. She steals before my eyes, hardening with determination. I bite my lip and wish I could do this alone, but she isn't going anywhere, standing over Ibram, close enough to stop if things get beyond my control. Ibram's eyes burn into mine, alight and intense as his mind bridges the divide between Ridge House and Piedmont. He already vomited out as much information as he could about the prison on the Piedmont base, the bunker half-buried with east-facing windows, which prisoners his brother can see, exactly who he's captured with, who he saw die, who he saw escape. To my relief, Ella and Rafe were among the survivors who made it into the swamps. That intelligence alone was vital, but this, Maven, right in front of us, so close I feel like I could almost reach out and touch him. I want to see what Ibram sees. I want to tip forward, plunge through the russet depths of his eyes, and emerge in the matching pair, staring out of a cell hundreds of miles away. Look Maven in the face again. Read him as I know I can. Every tick and pull of muscle under skin. The smallest flashes across ice-blue eyes, speaking of secrets and weaknesses he tries to bury. Ibram's connection to his brother will have to do. Their bond is strong despite the distance. Almost immediate. Ibram describes everything he senses through rash as it comes.
Maven is approaching the bars. He's leaning in, inches away. There's sweat on his neck. It's hot in Piedmont. It just rained.
Ibram tightens before me, laying his palms flat on his thighs. He draws back, and I imagine Maven right here in the room with us, crowding into his face. Ibram's lip curls in distaste.
He's searching us. Our eyes.
I flinch and feel the cold phantom of familiar breath on my skin. In spite of the sunlight streaming in through the single window, I feel darkness pool in this small, forgotten room hidden in Ridge House. I wish I'd never thought of this, had never summoned Ibram to do this. He was supposed to be our link to Tahir and Davidson, an easy connection to Montfort, not to his other brother, captured in Piedmont, not to Maven. I force myself to keep still, locking my muscles and my expression, but my heart gallops in my chest, rising to a dull, constant thud. Farley tries not to pace, and her odd lack of activity makes me even more nervous than I already am. This place disagrees with both of us. Ridge House seems like little more than a trap, waiting to be sprung. Every room has metal in some form, beamed or columned, or even woven into the floor itself. The house is a weapon only a few can wield, and they surround us at all times. Even the chair beneath me is cold steel. I shiver where it touches my bare skin. The knock on the door makes us both jump, startled out of our skin. I whirl, teeth clenched, to see the knob turn, catching fast against a lock. Farley crosses to the door in two long strides, ready to turn away whatever servant or snooping noble waits on the other side. To my dismay, she throws the door wide and steps back, allowing a broad, familiar silhouette to step into the room. I all but snarl at her, my fists clenching on my knees. "What are you doing?" I hiss, my voice low and firm. Tiberius glances between Farley and me, as if weighing the two of us, which female frightens him more.
"I was invited," he says thickly, "and we are going to be extremely late for a council meeting."
"Then go." I dismiss him with a wave, turning on Farley.
"What are you doing?"
I force through gritted teeth. She cuts me off with the sharp slam of the door. "You know Maven, but so does he," she says with cold efficiency. "Let him listen." In front of me, Ibram blinks.
Miss Barrow? He says, prodding for us to continue. As if this weren't stressful enough. Fine, I mutter through gritted teeth, turning back to face the Montfort new blood. I do my best to ignore the other Calore, now leaning against the wall to put as much space between us as he can. His foot taps in the corner of my eye in a burst of nervous energy. Maven is saying something. Ibram murmurs, his natural voice soft and halting. It shifts quickly into the best impression he can make of Maven. How are we speaking right now? He says, the words suddenly cruel and sharp. He even forces a cold laugh. It's a good likeness. Or are you just trying to toy with a king, Red? Not a good decision, I'm afraid. Ibram shifts again, his eyes darting, seeing across the miles. He has guards, sentinels, six of them. Prince Bracken and his children just passed through as well, with four guards of their own. Tiberius says something behind his hand, and Farley nods, adding to the count of hostiles, probably. Firm alliance with Bracken, I hear Tiberius mutter. They'll strike again, and soon. The queen is with him, Ibram continues. The Lakelander princess. She isn't speaking, just standing, watching. Ibram narrows his eyes. Her face is blank. She almost seems frozen. Tell Iris, I stumble, tapping my fingers together. They must be convinced, irrevocably sure it's me speaking through the brotherly bond. Tell her all dogs bite. All dogs bite, Iris. Ibram repeats. He tips his head as I tip mine, imitating me now, a common girl with an uncommon life. The truth unsettles Maven as much as anything, and I must unsettle him if I'm to get anything out of this exchange. The queen is smirking. She nods her head, Ibram says. He shifts into an impression of Iris, his voice climbing an octave. All dogs bite, but some dogs wait, Mare Barrow. And what is that supposed to mean? Farley grumbles into her hand. But I know. I'm just a well-dressed and tightly leashed lapdog, I told Iris once, during my imprisonment. She smirked then, too. Even lapdogs bite, she replied. Will you? I'm finally free to answer, and so is she. Iris Signet is waiting for her own opportunity to strike. I wonder if she has the Lakelands behind her, or just her own rage. I glance over my shoulder, looking to Farley. It's something she said to me in Archeon, before I came back. It's definitely her, but how, I can't say. Ibram continues, relaying Iris's voice the best he can. This must be some new blood ability we don't know yet. What you don't know could fill an ocean, I reply. About Montfort. About the Scarlet Guard? It feels shameful, dirty even, to jab like this, but I do it easily. About your brother? He's standing right next to me, you know. Ibram sneers, mimicking Maven. Is that supposed to mean something? I think there may be a tremor of fear in the echoed words. I have little regard for who you decide to stand next to, though, he adds, and his sneer curves into a wicked smile. I understand you aren't standing next to him much anymore. I force a smile, using it to mask my wince. Good to know you have spies in our coalition, I say boldly, although nowhere near as many as we have in yours. A laugh like nails on glass bursts from Ibram. You think I waste my spies on tracking your emotions, Mare? No, my darling, I just know you better than anyone else. He laughs again, showing white eye teeth. I focus on the scar on Ibram's chin to keep a picture of Maven's beautiful, haunted, hissing face out of my head. I knew you wouldn't stomach it when Cal showed who he truly was. At the edge of my vision, Tiberius doesn't move, doesn't even breathe. He keeps his eyes lowered, intent on glaring a hole in the floor. He is created as much as I am, made by our father, molded and broken into that walking, talking brick wall you thought you loved so well. Maven pushes on, speaking through Iberum. He hides behind that shield he calls duty, but the truth is less noble. Cal is made of want, same as the rest of us, but he wants the crown, he wants the throne, and no price is too high to pay, no blood too valuable to spill. A snap rips through the air as Cal cracks a single knuckle with his thumb. We always come back to the same conversation, Maven, I grumble, leaning back with exaggerated nonchalance. Iberum mirrors my motions. I wonder, Iris, does he whine about Tiberius as much to you, or am I the only one who has to deal with this nonsense? Iberum turns his head, as if looking to Iris. Her lips twitched. Perhaps a smile? He reports. Maven is shifting, putting an arm to the bars. The temperature is rising. Did I strike a nerve? I ask. Oh, I forgot. You don't know which nerves are even yours and which are hers. With a grimace, Iberum smacks his open palms on his thighs. Maven hit the bars. The temperature is still rising. The other prisoners are doing their best to watch. The new blood blinks, flaring his nostrils, forcing heavy breaths. He's trying to calm himself. It isn't wise to antagonize someone with so many hostages at his disposal. I could let them all burn if I wanted. Maven hisses through gritted teeth. I can smell his shaking anger from hundreds of miles away. It would be easy to report that there were no survivors of Bracken's glorious reclamation of his lands. It's true. There is nothing to stop Maven from murdering every prisoner in sight. They live on his whims alone, leaving an intricate needle for me to thread. Or you could free them. Maven barks a surprised laugh. I think you need to get more sleep, Mare. In a trade, of course. I glance up at Farley, weighing her expression. Her brows twitch, knitting together in thought. I see Tiberius pale, too. The last time we brokered a trade with Maven, I ended up imprisoned for months on end. Because that ended so well for us last time, Maven chuckles through Iberum's bond. But if you'd like to return and pretend you're doing it to save some nameless soldiers, then I'm happy to welcome you back. I thought Ilara killed your ability to dream, I snap back. No, Maven, I'm talking about what the Scarlet Guard left behind on Bracken's base. Iberum's face falls, matching the Boy King's. What? Farley grins, crouching next to me, addressing Iberum, and therefore Maven. The Scarlet Guard has a difficult time trusting Silvers, especially ones kept in check the way Bracken was. It was only a matter of time before something happened and he decided to stop taking orders from the people holding his children. Who am I speaking to now? Maven demands through Iberum. Oh, I'm hurt you don't remember me, but it's General Farley now, so maybe I sound different. Ah, yes. Iberum clucks his tongue. How foolish of me to forget the woman who led a wolf like me into her pack of particularly stupid sheep. Farley smiles like she's just been served a particularly delicious meal. These stupid sheep wired your base with explosives. For a second, the room goes deathly silent. Tiberius looks up, his face twisted in alarm. Do you have any idea how dangerous that was? Plenty, she snaps, not looking away from Iberum. Don't repeat that. He barely nods. Well, Maven? I ask, pasting on a sweet smile. You can recall whoever you sent into the swamps after our people and try to search the base before we obliterate it. Or you can release the prisoners and we'll tell you exactly how close you're standing to a bomb. Explosives don't frighten me. They would if you cared about the soldiers sworn to your crown. Tiberius growls, prowling close to my shoulder. His forearm brushes against me, sending a flare of heat down my spine. A shadow seems to pass over Iberum as he relays the prince's words and presence. Good of you to step forward, brother, Maven whispers. I thought you'd never find the spine to speak to me. Name the place and we'll see exactly who has the stronger spine. Tiberius fires back, his growl feral and unchecked. In reply, Ibram just wags a finger back and forth. Let's leave the posturing for your inevitable surrender, Cal. When you have to kneel before Norta, the Lakelands, and Piedmont. He rattles off each country with a spreading grin. I feel the weight stacking against us, the wall getting higher and higher. Farley puts a hand on my shoulder, holding me back to my chair, bidding me to wait. Finally, Ibera moves, crossing his arms and shifting his weight. His body language is all Maven, dedicated to a performance. Now he isn't wearing the false mantle of the young man called to duty. He dons the mask of the heartless, impenetrable son of Alara Mirandis, someone who cares only for power and nothing else. It is an act as much as Marina was to me. How many bombs did you say, General? He uses her rank to throw her off, but Farley is more difficult to rattle. I didn't. Hmm, Maven murmurs. Well, Bracken won't take kindly to any further damage done to his installation, though we bought enough goodwill returning his children, so he might not mind. I don't know exactly where the explosives might be, only that the guard planted them some time ago, buried them below the roads, the runways, and most of the administrative buildings. Where they could do the most damage, not just to enemy soldiers, but to the base itself. They're tuned to a specific frequency, triggered, and ready to blow. A perfect and deadly piece of foresight. The decision is yours, Maven. I answer. The prisoners for your base. Ibera mimics Maven's grin. And this new blood, of course. He says, though I'd like to keep him, if you don't mind. This is much easier than sending you letters. Not part of the deal. Pouting, Ibram huffs. You make things so difficult sometimes. It's my specialty. At my side, Tiberius scoffs quietly. I'm sure he agrees. We wait in blistering silence, hanging on every breath from Ibram's body. He turns in his seat, looking back and forth, pantomiming Maven as he paces. Farley looms above me, a storm cloud as much as I am. Where would you like them released? He says finally. Silently, Farley punches the air with a pair of brutal, triumphant jabs. I'm reminded of her young age. Only 22, just a few years older than me. East Gate, Farley replies, and I try to keep my triumph in check. The swamps. Dusk. I hear Maven's confusion. That's it? Tiberius is just as puzzled. He glances sidelong at Farley. That's no rescue, he murmurs, gesturing for Ibram not to relay his words. General, we need to get drop jets in place, a clear path, a ceasefire while we evacuate the prisoners and those who manage to escape. She slices a hand through the air. No need, Kalor. You keep forgetting the Scarlet Guard isn't the kind of army you're used to. Proud, she plants her hands on her hips. There's already infrastructure in place, and we have boots on the ground in the swamps already. Moving Reds across enemy territory is sort of what we're best at. Good to hear, Tiberius grinds out. But I don't like being left out of the loop. We work better with everyone on even ground. You call this even ground? Farley says, gesturing between him and us. His blood, our blood. His rank, our rank. The canyon between a silver born to be a king and reds born to nothing at all. His eyes flicker, dancing from her down to me. He towers over me in my seat, his height exaggerated by the distance. So much space between us, and yet none at all. Though it pains him, Tiberius bites his tongue, and a muscle feathers in his cheek as he wrenches his gaze from mine. I see the struggle in him, and I expect him to push, keep arguing. To my surprise, he settles back, gesturing for us to continue. In front of me, Ibram heaves a breath. He touches the scar on his chin, brown skin nubbled white between the curls of his black beard. Then he brushes the flesh below each of his eyes, where the scars of his brothers lie. The king lingers, thinking, Miss Barrow. Tell him he won't be able to use us this way again, he says, now pleading, or this wretched young man will keep my brother as his prisoner, as a channel to you and his majesty. Of course, I reply, bobbing my head, eager to save Rash from becoming another New Blood pet. We'll know if you keep the New Blood, Maven, and if you do, the deal is broken. The responding voice is bitter, but unsurprised. But I've missed our conversations. You keep me sane, Mare, he tells me, trying for dark humor. It lands poorly. We both know that isn't true, and you will never communicate with me through him again. He scowls. Then we'll have to find new ways to talk. Above me, Tiberius lifts a finger, signaling for Iberum's attention. If you want to talk, no one will stop you, Maven, he says, and the New Blood relays. Wars are fought with diplomacy as much as weaponry. Meet us on neutral ground, face to face. So eager to negotiate surrender, Cal? Maven taunts, waving away the offer. Now, General, the explosives? Farley nods. You'll be given their locations after we can verify that our people are in the swamps and out of harm's way. I won't be held responsible for anything an alligator does. At this, she truly laughs. It's a pity you have no soul, Maven Kalor. You could have been someone worth saving. Tiberius shifts, unsettled. If someone can fix him, isn't it worth it to try? He asked me that a few weeks ago, skin to skin. It feels like another life. It isn't a subject I care for. There is no fixing Maven, no redemption for the boy king, for the false person we both loved. We can't save him from himself. And I don't think I'll ever have the heart to tell Tiberius that. As broken as Maven's ability to love is, Tiberius's is that much stronger. To a fault, perhaps. It makes him cling too tight. First, you burn Corvium. Now, you threaten the Piedmont base. Maven sneers through the bond. The Scarlet Guard is so talented at destruction, but then it's always easier to tear down what is already built. Especially when what you build is rotten to the core, Farley sneers back. East Gate, the swamps, dusk, I repeat, or the base burns beneath you. My foot twitches beneath me. How many are on the base now? Soldiers oathed to Maven and Bracken and Iris? Silvers, probably, and Reds, too. Their shield wall of innocence following orders. At first I tell myself not to think about it. War is difficult enough without weighing how many lives hang in the balance. But closing my eyes isn't the answer either. No matter how hard it is to see, I have to look. Even if I have to make the hard decision, I must do it with my eyes open. No more pushing down the pain or the guilt. I have to feel it if I want to get through it. Very well. Maven growls. Again, I picture him standing outside a cell, white-faced in the dim light, his eyes rimmed with the usual shadows of exhaustion and doubt. I am a man of my word. The familiar refrain smarts like his brand, drawing out a dozen harsh memories of his letters and his promise. Slowly, I nod. You're a man of your word.